Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to our official coverage of the Bigfoot Roadshow here in Mineola, Texas. We are joined right now with the amazing King Gerhardt. How are you doing today?
I'm fantastic, Chris.
Man,
thank you for coming out to the event and supporting everyone, and it's good to be here with you.
You know, actually, the Squatch scene is one of my favorites. It is really a true community of people.
No doubt.
I can't wait to actively go to MUFONCon this year and join that community and see what that's about. But even just last night at the dinner, all that stuff, just seeing the community of people sitting around talking that go to each other's shows, stuff like that. It reminds me a lot of the Comic Cons that I went to when I was coming up, all that stuff. So I love it, and I love the fact that folks like you have the opportunity to come out and share your work and your years of research with average people who may not normally have that access to someone like you and someone of your caliber. So thank you for coming out to events like this.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Like you said, there's a great sense of camaraderie, and I'm actually blessed to do Bigfoot events around the country.
Yeah.
So there's a Bigfoot community as a whole, and everyone pretty much knows everyone else, but there's also kind of like regional flavors.
Yeah.
So like the Ohio Bigfoot Conference versus, you know, Oregon or Texas or whatever. But here in Texas, and in the South in particular, you know, it's like a big family. Mm. And we've all known each other for years, and we enjoy supporting each other at these types of events. So.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I know I've had Craig Woolheater on the show numerous times, and even just having him on and the relationship that we have now, it's great to see that, and it's fantastic. Just inside, a minute ago, you were talking about an expedition that you went on with Daniel Allen Jones this last year.
Correct.
Looking for giant salamanders. Tell us a little bit about that real quick.
Yeah. So when we say giant salamanders, most people are familiar with salamanders. And the known species in North America, probably the largest one, is called the hellbender, which is in the eastern U.S. And it can get to be like a couple feet long, which is pretty darn big. But embedded within Bigfoot literature, you will often hear these stories and accounts of monstrous salamanders in the same areas that the Bigfoot is said to inhabit in Northern California. The area around the Klamath River, Bluff Creek, Trinity River, and so forth. And these accounts date back to the 1920s. They're actually Native American traditions, too.
Oh, wow.
But as far as, like, modern sightings go back to the 1920s and 40s, and people would claim to come across these salamanders that were, like, 5 to 9 feet long, which is at least as big or much bigger than any known species. Huge.
That's a pretty big amphibian. Like reptiles get that big.
Yes.
Even here in the United States.
That's a good point. You know, and we could talk about, there were actually amphibians that large in the past, you know, if you look
historic records.
Yeah. If you know, dating back to the Carboniferous, which was the age of amphibians, you have some like 15 foot long, you know, Alambomeres and some of those. But anyways, we basically just wanted to do an expedition to search for these giant salamanders. There have been periodic expeditions throughout the decades, some funded by Tom Slick, who is kind of a pioneer in the Bigfoot field.
And so
we went up there, a team of us from Texas and Oklahoma, as you mentioned, me, Daniel Allen Jones, Jason Kontz Coburn, who's a Texas Bigfoot researcher and exotic animal handler, and Jim Whitehead, who's a Bigfoot researcher and wildlife biologist from Oklahoma who specializes in amphibians. So we all went out there. We met up with Jamie Wayne, who is a member of the Bluff Creek Project, which is the group that has been managing the site where the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot. And they've basically been documenting and maintaining that for years. And, so we went up there and, you know, we looked for giant salamanders. We had underwater cameras and nets, and we spent a lot of time wading the, you know, they're fast-running, cold streams. You know, we're basically just poking our hands under rocks.
Yeah, just noodling style.
Basically.
Yeah,
that's, yeah. And, you know, I consulted with wildlife biologists who do giant amphibian surveys in Asia and stuff, and that's what they do. They sweep the... So we didn't... Unfortunately, we didn't find any monster salamanders, but, you know, it was a good experiment and a good way to kind of develop a methodology, a process, if you will. And also, you know, we saw some just unbelievable habitat, very remote, untouched ancient forests in Northern California, no logging, no development, pretty remote. And so there, you know, certainly is at least a biological viability that such a species could exist, similar to the cryptobranchids of Asia. And, you know, we always kind of had an eye open, you know, in our peripheral vision for maybe a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch that might be peeking out. And we got to the cherry on top of the cake was we got to visit the film site. So I've never been to the Patterson-Gimlin film site. And I actually got to walk the trajectory where the subject in the film walked and just get a perspective as far as what was going on.
And that must be especially really interesting for a researcher like you to go and see the actual perspective, the scale perspective of things.
Yes.
Stuff like that.
And it's changed a bit. You know, you can imagine when that film was shot on October 20th, 1967, this was a couple years after a major flood event in that area. So everything had been flattened and it was pretty much, you can see the downed trees and stuff in the footage, but it's kind of grown up, you know, and there are new trees there and stuff. The creek has moved, so it's like farther, you know, farther away from where the film was shot, and it's actually very lush. I mean, it's kind of like a rainforest kind of feel around the creek, you know.
Wow.
We didn't see Bigfoot there, but and the Bluff Creek Project has actually put up a number of trail cams all over that area since 2012, hoping that they would get something. But they did actually. The one thing that they did accomplish, which is pretty amazing, is they documented a type of marten, which is a mustelid. That it was supposedly the Humboldt Martin, which was supposedly extinct, and they caught one on film.
Wow.
So there are things out there.
In the same case with the ivory-billed woodpecker here recently.
Yep.
That was confirmed much in the same way, where it was a random trail cam that was done for totally different research.
Sure.
Now, I want to say I talked with Daniel Allen Jones on the show about, you know, being able to actively get grants through universities, things like that, that are actively doing wildlife studies to be able to go out and, sure, you're using it for this, but you can still provide them with the footage. You can still provide them with trail cam pictures, things like that, that help them in their research as well, and kind of piggyback on that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're a lot of us, most of us are citizen scientists, as Daniel so eloquently put it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We try to follow scientific, you know, methods and, you know, use critical thinking and remain objective, but it's all about evidence, you know, trying to find definitive evidence. And, but there's not a lot of funding for us, you know, cryptid hunters. So, you know, we're pretty much all self-funded and stuff, which, you know, is fine. I'm not complaining, but it makes it harder sometimes to achieve these lofty goals that we set for ourselves.
Well, you know, it can make it hard to mount a month-long expedition out in the field when you have to make appearances or, you know, go out and make sure that you're still writing on your new book, things like that, which is an always constant work in progress for folks like you, for researchers like you, because that is like how you make your living is writing your books from your research.
Yeah, pretty much appearing at events like this. You know, we sell a few books here and there, and you know, whatever we can do to kind of, you know, fund our research. And
well, I know you'll be selling some to me today.
Awesome.
What was it? Because one of my favorite things is always finding out, like, what was the first ring of the bell for you? Like, growing up in Houston for me in the 80s, the gargoyle incident that Daniel was talking about, I remember that being spoken about. I grew up right down the road from the Cash Landrum incident.
Oh, wow.
And heard scuttlebutt about that, you know, amongst uncles, things like that, growing up in the area. But what was it for you that first made you decide to go down this path as your path of calling? Is your path of vocation?
Well, of course, people ask me that a lot because it's kind of an untraditional way to go about life. But, you know, I never planned to make this a career.
Yeah.
It's been a lifelong passion since I was a little kid. And what I always tell people is, you know, my father was a scientist, so I was raised in kind of an academic household where we, you know, learned about deductive reasoning and things at a young age. And my mother was a travel agent, and she loved to travel and explore, very pioneering kind of spirit. And two of my loves when I was a kid were animals and creatures. I had my first pet was a small alligator called a caiman, and I had a lot of exotic collected snakes and salamanders and things. And I also loved monster movies. You know, I was raised on Godzilla and Creature from the Black Lagoon and all those classics.
Totally.
So when I first heard about, well, I saw a TV show about Bigfoot when I was about 9 years old. Just came on one Saturday morning, and it was just like something inside me clicked. Because if you think about it, something like Bigfoot, it kind of combines or synthesizes monsters and animals or creatures. You know, it's kind of like both. And that's what cryptozoology is really about. It's about animals and creatures if you do it traditionally.
Sure.
And follow the zoology. But it can also, they're often like fabulous legends and stories and things.
Yeah.
So that was just something I was, you know, since I was a kid, I've absorbed everything I could on the subject. And then when I was 15 years old, my mom arranged for my father and I to visit Loch Ness in Scotland.
Oh, cool.
And my dad's an avid angler, so we were doing a lot of fishing while we were up there. But, of course, I spent most of the time trying to find out about Nessie, the Loch Ness monster. So I had an 8mm movie camera. I was interviewing locals. I was hiking around the lake and trying
Epic.
To... Yeah, I so I was 15
it.
Years old. I was
That's
trying to
great.
Do field research. So it's just been a lifelong passion of mine, and I've just been very blessed, Chris, in terms of having opportunities to write books and do TV shows.
Yeah.
And so,
and
you know,
what does your father think of your research?
Oh, he's very proud.
That's awesome. That's great to hear.
He just recently retired. He was, after years of, you know, doing science and different things, he became a math teacher at my old high school. And teaching advanced, you know, calculus or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he always liked the first day of school, he would, you know, bust out a couple of my videos from my TV shows. And, you know, this is my son looking for Bigfoot and stuff. So he's very,
that's great.
It is, you know, everyone, you always want your parents to be proud of you. And
yeah.
Especially when you do something really weird. So,
well, and especially, you know, it's great knowing that your father is proud, especially since he is a scientist.
Yeah.
You know, because it could very easy be the case of like, look, this here is my crazy son who goes out and does this stuff. But that's not what he does. So the fact that he is legitimately interested in your research and sees it as credible is a beautiful thing.
Thank you. That's a good
great.
Point. I don't know. You know, we haven't had serious discussions. Now, his specialty is more like he's a forestry professor, statistician. He counts trees and things like that. But, he's definitely he's open-minded. And I think that's a true scientist, I think, always has to remain somewhat open-minded and objective to any theory or hypothesis.
One of the points I bring up with Craig Woolheater, the Southeast Texas Bigfoot folks, anybody, whenever we're talking Bigfoot or cryptids, is don't forget, last year during a pandemic, we found 1,000 new species.
Mm.
During a pandemic, like, research and travel was shut down.
It's true.
And there was 1,000 new species found. Take a look at any map of the U.S. at night taken by NASA, and almost the entire region where most Bigfoot sightings happen is black. So that means, like, it is not settled the way the rest of it is. There's no people out there like that. So, yeah, there is a great swath of America that is still unsettled, untouched, like you said, the forest out in California was. So there's a great possibility of there being a good home range.
Now, that's you stated the argument beautifully there, Chris. And, you know, what I try to tell people, and particularly in this day and age, it's pretty easy for humans to feel omnipotent with, you know, with our smartphones and stuff, because you can Google anything, and, you know, we've got this all figured out. Well, I have, as I said, I have traveled around the world to 26 different countries. I've camped along the Amazon River. I've hiked the Australian outback. I've, you know, been to jungle habitats around the world. And, you know, you're right. I mean, there's, based on one recent survey, I think at least 47% of the Earth's land surface, we're not talking about the We're not even talking about the deep oceans, which have anything down there, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
But 47% of the land surface still is technically classified as a wilderness area, meaning
that
humans don't live there. And think about all of the jungles, swamps, forests, mountain ranges, tundras, deserts. I mean, there's just a lot of places that humans don't live. And so that, there's always that potential there for discovery.
Well, and much like whenever we have whistleblowers or anything on the show, I'm always bound to believe them are a victim until I hear the other side. I am always more bound to believe a thousand years or so of tradition from Native people and their stories of what's over there and what Grandpa said was over there and what Dad said was over there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sure they've been around a little bit longer than us and have that oral tradition, you know. Maybe we should heed it a little bit and check into it,
yeah,
you know, instead of just dismissing it so outright sometimes.
That's a good point. And, you know, I have, you know, also been blessed to, you know, have conversations with indigenous peoples in different areas, the Ketchke Mai of Central America.
Oh, wow.
Inuit people in Alaska and, you know, other tribes around the world. And, you know, we always have to honor and respect their traditions, I think, because they've, like you said, they've lived in certain areas for a long time. They know what animals live around them and stuff. But, you know, they don't frequently, a lot of those native cultures and traditions are not readily shared with, quote unquote, outsiders.
Yeah. True.
You know, the culture, you know, it's their identity. It's what belongs to them. And so as much as we would like to think that we could, as a Bigfoot researchers, you know, go onto a reservation, I'm just speaking hypothetically here,
absolutely.
And say, tell us about your, you know, Bigfoots. And
here's my cameras.
They may or may not, you know, depending. And I've,
that's absolute truth.
So, I mean, they probably, and I have found also in recent years, having had the opportunity to speak to some Native Americans, for example, that there seem to be a lot more sightings and activity of Bigfoot in and around reservations and traditional areas where they've lived.
Oh.
And you think about it, this makes a lot of sense because we know that Native Americans have, you know, been here at least 12,000 years, maybe 30, 50,000 years. And if Bigfoot or Sasquatch exists, it certainly feels more comfortable probably being around these people that it's been lived alongside of for 12,000 years as opposed to these newcomers.
It's a known quantitative.
Yeah.
It's a known quantitative as far as a wild animal goes. No different than when you move in the neighborhood if the coyotes come by or not for a little while.
Exactly.
And,
so, you know,
much less, like you said, living in the same area, knowing the same places to go get game, knowing the same places to go graze. For food, things like that. Those are things that, the tribe would know for hundreds of years on the back end. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, this time of year, you can go over there and catch salmon that are landlocked right now. You know, stuff like that. So, absolute internal knowledge that, like you said, would not typically be shared with outsiders or anything like that. So, really interesting that there are more... that there seemed to be an uptick of sightings around those areas.
Yeah, that's what I've, you know, at least, like I said, it seems to be that way, you know, and it just, that's, as you kind of immerse yourself in the subject matter of Bigfoot or whatever cryptid or whatever in general, sometimes even someone like me that's been doing it for decades, new information surfaces or you get a new perspective on something and it kind of, you know, that's really the fun part of doing it.
Yeah.
Kind of new information and new trails to follow.
And so. I mean, I even had an experience in Louisiana. My aunt used to date one of the chiefs of the Coushatta Indian tribe.
Okay.
We were out on their property one time for just a family event, all up around this campfire at like 11 o'clock at night. And I saw literally a mountain lion walk by on the dirt road.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, hey, man, like, anybody else just see that lion? A couple of my family members were like, I think your extracurriculars are taking over, Chris. and the next day, like, I saw large cat prints out in the road. And I was like, look, I told you. Man, there are no mountain lions out here. Like, that's a dog print. Like, I don't know. And that is when I ran across the Jaguarundi.
Okay.
In Houston, and like sightings all across Houston for years, things like that.
Sure.
Actually, the come to find out the source of the name of Houston Cougars was actually sightings of that.
Yep.
All kinds of things. So it was one of those like, wow, cryptids right in my backyard. Like I lived in Spring Branch, Houston, and it was like this is literally Buffalo Bayou. Like, this is my backyard that they're talking about. And to know that now Texas Parks and Wildlife has seen Jaguarundi, they have seen tracks of Jaguarundi, and apparently the population is back on the rise. So something that was once a known species that became possibly extinct and became kind of a cryptid, where it was like, hey, I saw this thing.
Right.
People are like, no, you're crazy. Ends up, no, they are back. They are on the rise. So there are so many cases like that. It's really interesting.
No, that's a great illustration. And of course, in terms of animals, cats are among the most elusive species because they're very stealthy ambush predators. So they're good at hiding and not being seen.
Yeah, solitary typically.
I mean, I investigated a case in Mexico in 2014. This was on the Science Channel. They made an episode of it where there were a lot of livestock killings. Mysterious. A number of goats had been killed in like one night. It was crazy. It was like 80 goats had been attacked and killed by something. And of course, again, we're talking about the traditional people of that area. It was the chupacabra.
Oh.
Or it was the nahual. It was some legendary creature that did this. And based on the wounds that I examined on these, you know, I was shown photographs and stuff, I thought, you know, this looks like a mountain lion did this. Mm. And I did some research on that, and I found out that actually it's very rare, but there have been episodes, documented episodes, where mountain lions have gone psycho and gotten into a sheep or goat pen and killed dozens of animals. And they're not hungry.
Oh, it's no, just, no, no,
it's
no.
Just, it's just,
it's
a,
just bloodlust.
It's bloodlust. It's like they just go, it's well, like a... But
no different than any cat that's going to just play with a bird in the backyard that it pounces on and then leave it there
kills
and not
a
eat
lizard
it,
and
or
just
brings
walk.
It to you as a present.
Exactly. But anyways, my point with this is, these people had lived there for generations, and these goat farmers, and I mentioned that to them. I said, I think it was actually a mountain lion that got in your pen, and they told us, oh, there are no mountain lions here. We've never seen a mountain lion. And I was like, they're here. Mountain lions are the most widespread mammal, one of the most widespread mammals in North America, from Alaska to Argentina. I mean, they are,
but
you don't see them.
And they
might see their tracks, but you don't.
And they've got a home range that is literally miles in breadth for each one. It's pretty amazing. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to come by, talk. I know you're working a booth and selling books, all that kind of stuff, but truly a pleasure. We'd love to have you on. Anytime you have new books coming out, things like that. We love promoting people's work, making sure that it can get out there to as many people as possible. It's only through being curious and exploring these options that we find new sciences, that we find new species, that we evolve as people, period. You can never stop asking questions. So.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you for
great conversation. Thank you for having me on. And let's do this again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too.
Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thanks.
Man, incredible stuff. Super fun. We will be right back here in just a few minutes, folks. Everybody, welcome back to our live coverage of the Texas Bigfoot Roadshow here in Mineola. We just got done with the Bigfoot calling contest at lunch. I am not sure who the winner is, but there were some great calls out there. Joining us in this segment from Paranormal and Plastic, the amazing Charlie Perez, a great artist. I actually found him on social media after I became a sponsor of this event and started just tagging around the communities, stuff like that. And ran across, I guess it was the first figure that you put up, I think it was for the Folk Monster Festival that was coming up.
That's correct.
And I was like, wow, that work is, I'm an action figure freak. I'm a kid of the 80s, like I was telling you at your table. We've just been revolving around each other for years in communities in Houston with the Comic-Con community over there. So great to see you at an event like this, and also great to see you producing action figures of the paranormal. It's a totally great niche market. It's absolutely phenomenal, and your work is just top-notch and beautiful, man. It really, really is. Tell us a little bit about Paranormal and Plastic and... what got you into creating action figures, stuff like that?
Okay, so I've been a fan of the paranormal since I was really little. favorite shows were like Monster Quest.
Mm.
There was a show called Weird Travels.
If you remember that.
Yeah, that's probably the first one I saw.
Okay.
And so another thing that I like is toys, action figures of superheroes, like Marvel Comics and DC.
Totally.
And so I decided, I think around the time I was in high school, to start customizing my own toys, because some toys don't get made.
Yeah.
And they were terrible at first. I didn't know what I was doing.
Well, what were you using whenever you had, just for artists out there that are maybe wanting to get into the field, you know? I mean, were you using, like, the baked clay?
I was using, like, air-dry clay.
Yeah.
It chips and it falls apart. I was using craft paint.
Okay.
I forget, the company has the logo is an apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can find them at Hobby Lobby.
Yeah, it's like the kindergarten paints, stuff like that you use on ceramics. That
yeah,
kind
exactly.
Of thing.
And so, I started trying to make them better. Around maybe 2 years ago, I started making them for sale and listing them on eBay. So one thing that I like to delve into is pulp era superheroes.
Uh-huh.
So my favorite's the Phantom.
Okay.
The Shadow.
Yeah.
And then it can also go over to like detective stuff like Dick Tracy.
Oh, sure,
like that.
Sure.
And so I started making figures of them, specifically the Phantom, because that was a big seller.
Yeah.
And listing them and selling them on eBay. And then I was, one day, Josh Turner from Paranormal Roundtable reached out to me and asked if I could make figures of some of his friends, like Lyle Blackburn, Gerhard, and Nick Redfern, who are actually here at the show right
now. Yep, yep.
And so I went on his show, and people might have seen me on there, and I created a bunch of paranormal-themed action figures, calling it Paranormal in Plastic. So I owe a lot of this to Josh. And then I kind of expanded over last Christmas, reaching out to different podcasters, paranormal investigators.
Totally.
Some of the people I've made figures for are Shannon Legro.
Yep.
Ryan Sprigg.
Yeah, I've seen him.
What do you think? Seth Breedlove I've gotten to.
Nice.
And one person who has really helped me out financially and supportively is Lauren Coleman from the museum.
That's
up in Portland.
Great to hear. Yeah, I lived in Portland, Maine for many years, and right as I moved, I would see his Bigfoot car around town, his cryptomobile. And it was like, oh, there he is. And I could never track him down. And right as I moved, I think a month later, the crypto museum opened. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, it just broke my heart that I was right there. And I've yet to be back. But I've seen the entire collection.
Yeah, he's been collecting some of my figures for his museum.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I've visited about twice before, but I haven't been there to see the display.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really cool, man. And what is your process? I mean, are you 3D printing? Are you molding from hand? Is it epoxy resin mold?
So currently, I don't have a printer or a 3D printer. I take previous figures, like if people are familiar with Hasbro Marvel Legends.
Yep.
Definitely take a lot of those and whatever I can find and then mold on top of that.
Okay.
So it takes a while. Last year, I was more free to do this, and I could get maybe four figures done a week. But now I'm up down to like two figures a week, just because of like work.
Yeah,
I'm going back to school, taking some classes for a new degree.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a long process now. It's taking up a lot of my. I would say work is what's taking up a lot of time. This is really what I want to do.
Yeah. I don't know an artist out there that doesn't want to make that their going concern. And mm-hmm. even with what you're doing now, it's really just phenomenal work, mm-hmm. man.
What area do you live in?
I live in Austin.
Austin, so, okay. Yeah, I'm up there quite a bit sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, my whole family's from the west side of Houston, all that kind of stuff. Katy, Spring Branch area.
So you come to? Do you go to a lot of the shows in Houston?
Yeah. I mean, typically I'm there with my podcast Cadet Company, doing live streams and doing
doing, you know, podcast instructional things at Comic Palooza, that kind of stuff. We partnered with them quite a few times to come and give our workshops and things like that for free. So, yeah, I mean, it's really a great community, and much like the communities like this, like we were talking about with King Gerhardt earlier, so entirely supportive of the people and the artisans within the community. And how have these been received? How has the social media response been? Things like that.
People tend to like them. A lot of people ask how they can buy them.
Yeah.
The hard part is telling them, you know, a lot of them go to different people that have ordered them.
Yeah.
So I don't have a surplus of inventory.
Yeah.
It's basically by order, and I'm trying to fulfill those orders as fast as I can.
Yep.
And so some people I can't get to, and it's very disappointing to disappoint them.
Yeah, yeah, I could see how that could be frustrating to not be able to fill a demand that, you know, somebody has, because it is, like you said, a time-consuming and very, very art-intensive process. Now, with your process, is it something that... because obviously you must either have a vast collection of things to build on top of.
I do.
Or, which I don't know, a builder out there that doesn't just have like drawers of, you know.
Body parts.
I'm sure yours is just drawers of body parts. Mine's drawers of just electronic parts and things like that. So, same thing, different story. But, man, is it one of those that... whenever you see a figure or somebody mentions a figure, do you already have a figure that you're going to change in mind? Like,
sometimes,
ooh, you know, like, yeah, that totally reminds me of, like, the Iceman from the original 80s or, like, the original 90s run, you know, stuff like that.
It's more one for actual people.
Okay.
I have to find the right head to use as a base.
Sure.
And sometimes it's a long process of me just sitting there thinking of what I'm going to use. But I use Ave's epoxy sculpt to build on top of that head, or really whatever.
Yeah.
And it's not the best if you look up close, but it's, I think it looks good.
I mean, it looks fantastic, man. And I'm pretty up close to Blackula right now. And that is some pretty impressive detail. And to know that you are hand-painting these things, that you are hand-sculpting these, that it's not like you've gone through the effort to make a rubber mold, to epoxy mold things, or anything like that.
So far, I haven't gotten into molds. I'd like to make it faster, but I'm still learning how to do all this stuff. And one thing I am going to try to expand to, aside from 3 3/4-inch figures now, I also want to expand maybe into, like, obscure horror movie characters.
Okay.
So that's why I have Blackula here. Blackula is a movie that I happen to like.
I love that
movie. I think it's hilarious.
It is one of my favorites of all time, man.
But then there's characters like Kurt Barlow from Salem's Lot.
I
definitely want to make that.
Yeah.
There's one of my favorite movies, Nosferatu. The character of Count Orlok's my favorite.
Nice.
Maybe making him. And then another movie that I love is the original Fright Night.
Yeah. Oh.
They're making Jerry Dandridge in his vampire face.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
That would
movies
be epic.
Like that.
Yeah. And you know as well as I do, especially in Houston, folks out there, if you are in the Houston area and you do not know about, like, the Houston horror pop-ups that happen, the Houston horror markets, stuff like that, our good friend Scary Dad, Billy Stewart, Scott Fontenot, those guys that put on all those things, if you aren't connected with them...
Yeah,
we definitely need to talk if you don't know the guys I'm talking about, because you need a booth at their stuff, man. They do horror pop-ups all over the place. You definitely need to have these out there.
If you know Misfit Toys up in the Montrose area.
Yeah, shout out to those guys, man. And, I mean, even Christine Nix and all that. It's a really great community to get involved in. And once again, it's so supportive, not only in artistic advice, but how to market yourself, how to get out there, how to appear at conventions like this. They're so entirely helpful. So if you are one of those people that's a maker, a creator, go out to an event like this and literally just ask. You know, people will more than gladly share, like, how to become a vendor, that kind of stuff. So
there's also another side of the toy community that I've been a part of for past half a year now, maybe a little bit more. It's been more about a year now. There's groups like Super Happy Incredible Toys, if you know them.
Okay.
They throw shows all the time. There's the Houston Toy Psychos.
All right.
There's an antique store off of Beltway 8 and I-10, if you know that, the antique marketplace.
Right over by the Archery Center.
I have a bunch of friends there that have shops.
Yeah.
And I'm always hanging out with them and setting up at all the toy shows.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually one of the hidden gems in town that, like, you got to go and scour it pretty regularly to find things.
You've been there a lot.
Oh God, yeah. Like the old guy in the middle of he used to occupy the middle of the place with a record shop.
Yeah, he's still there.
Is he? I thought he passed away.
The record shop guy?
Well, this guy used to have, like, old reel-to-reel tape machines that he would get.
Phonographs? He's still there.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know Stephen King?
Yep.
From Fun King Toys?
Yeah.
He's a good friend of mine.
Absolutely. And that's just it. Like, there are so many little niche places like that if you know about them, creators like you can really go out and entrench themselves in a community. Mm-hmm. It's really, really nice. So what are some of your things to... What are some of your favorite things to mod? What is it that, you know...
I like using Hasbro Marvel Legends.
Okay.
NECA Toys.
Okay.
Mainly Marvel Legends, good thing to use. For example, the Falcon Monster here, I used standard Marvel Legends body to build off on top of. The new X-Men line had a head on a character named Wild Child.
Yep.
That's what I used for the head, modified the nose, the hair, and the brow.
Wow.
But you can see that's Black Panther hands, feet from, can't remember where.
But Beast then, or something.
And then you can see the sculpt that I put on top of it.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah, I see what you're talking about now, where you've taken hands from one, feet from another, and that it's just fantastically detailed work, man. It is really, really beautiful. Are you pursuing a degree in art or anything
like that? No, I have a degree in business.
Okay.
This is a passion of mine.
Yeah.
But really, at the end of the day, I'm trying to make money because I need...
Sure.
I have a girlfriend that I want to get married to eventually.
All right.
So I'm trying to experiment with my career because I'm pretty young.
Sure. Yeah, no, and, I was probably about 28 when doing AV became, like, a full-time concern for me. And I remember my family even at the time. When are you going to stop playing with all these wires and stuff, you know, between Wednesday and Friday and go out and get a job?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I tour the country and, you know, handle AV at large conferences.
And you make a good living?
I make a great living. I love what I do every day. I just love wires. I love patching cables. It's my groove, you know? Even things like here today where tech issues happen and I can't not just like, okay, what do you need help with?
Mm-hmm.
And just go up and start patching things. So, yeah, it's one of those, I am one of the blessed individuals that I don't work. I love what I do every single day, you know? And, yeah, it takes a little while to get there. It takes a minute, and yes, it absolutely, shout out to Amy. I love you, baby. It does definitely take an absolute capital P partner, somebody that is there and on board with you 100%, despite what happens, you know, and on board with you and what you want to do and supporting that. So good on you for finding the right lady who is good with that, because they are all, you know, not everybody is supportive of a loved one's passions necessarily. Mm-hmm. So if you have that, hold on tight, brother. It's a beautiful thing. And you'll get there. It's a time whittle, you know, like you have a business degree. I don't know if I've ever attended a business conference that I've worked where I don't hear the time or money equation. It's either time or money. And as long as you have the time to invest in it, be able to do things and keep it moving and keep the momentum going, it will happen.
Yeah,
it will happen.
I work a 9-to-4 job every day of the week.
Okay.
Do this in the evenings until like midnight.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm up late.
I can appreciate.
But the scary thing is, like, if I went full-time on this, could I make a living? That's the... That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that is definitely a market flex and a test, and let's test out this market. And would people be interested in this niche market of characters? That kind of stuff, which, yeah, takes quite a bit of demographic market research. You know, I mean, just ask Hasbro.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like you can exactly go out making cartoons to promote your toys yet. Yet. Soon, someday. But tell everybody where they can go to get your stuff, eBay store, website.
So previously I was posting a lot on eBay. I haven't done that in a while. I want to. I'm going to try and make an overstock of figures and then have some on eBay. I'm wondering if cryptozoology figures will sell on eBay. Because so far I've been marketing those towards the paranormal investigators themselves. But you can contact me through Instagram, Facebook, and I try to get back to as many people as I can.
What are your handles? What are your handles? Instagram, on Insta, Twitter,
on Facebook. You can. I have a page for Charlie's Custom Toys.
Okay,
but I don't post on there as much. Mainly, I post on my personal page, which is Charlie D. Perez, and then I also post under Charlie's Custom Toys on Instagram, and I have a separate page for Paranormal and Plastic.
Great. Fantastic. Well, Charlie, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. Once again, I've been Google stalking you, as you could probably tell,
since we
met on social media, and your work is just absolutely jaw-droppingly incredible.
Yeah, if you visit the page, like and follow, share there. Do whatever
Absolutely.
And to get it out in the world.
You bet, man. And we'll definitely be sharing links to you whenever all this comes out, other than live, all that kind of good stuff. But thank you so much for taking the time. I want to make sure you have some time to hit the people that are out checking out your booth, everything else. So thank you so much. Appreciate you. Yeah. Stay tuned, folks. We will be coming back to you here in just a few minutes from the Mineola Bigfoot Festival. We had a great time a little while ago talking with King Gerhardt, who's walking by right now, Charlie D. Perez from Paranormal and Plastic. I'm telling you, folks, if you haven't seen his stuff, just go check that out. I mean, look at that. That should autofocus there. But anyway, we'll talk to you guys soon. Take care. Stay curious. We'll be back here in just a little while with more guests, more coverage. See you soon. Bye-bye. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry.
specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome back to our continuing coverage of the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Festival here in Mineola, Texas. We just got done having some fantastic presentations over in the Historic Select Theater. With me is the presenter that just got off stage a few minutes ago, as well as the gentleman who runs the Historic Select Theater, the annex that we are in right here, as well as the Curiosity Shop next door. We have with us Mr. George Jones. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me, and I'm doing pretty good.
Absolutely, man. It's I did not have a chance to make it out here to the Tyler Paracon. That was last weekend, right?
It was.
How did that go? Did you have a good showing?
It was great. I'm still tired from that.
It takes a lot out of you, man. I've traveled the country doing live AV, and it's one of those, I tell my wife all the time, it's not the work, it's the state of constant cat-like readiness.
Right.
It's the 11 p.m. I get a text from somebody, hey, house knocked two speakers down. You need to come in at 4 a.m. and set them back up.
That's the truth.
Things like that. So, yeah, it does really, really wear on you and take a lot, especially when you're organizing an event like Tyler Paracon or this for a good 6 months before it happens. So, glad to hear that you had a good showing, and great to see that even the weekend after that the town isn't showed out, you know?
Right, yeah.
Instead, they showed out.
Yeah, I've been very happy with the turnout for both events. It's been really great. And what you were saying, you're right. It's kind of the tension.
Yeah.
It's what keeps me going.
Yeah.
If I have a beer a couple of days before it, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm going to just lay down and take a nap.
Yeah, absolutely. You really do have to kind of learn to live off of that adrenaline for a little while. And when it's, you can ask my wife, now that COVID's over, it's granted I call it my travel hangover,
because
I'll be gone for 7-10 days at a time. And when I come back, I'm in a robe for a day and a half. Like, I can do my expenses, and that's about the bandwidth I got.
At least you were in a robe.
So, right? Well, tell us a little bit about the Curiosity Shop, because I happened to go by there earlier, pick up a nice piece of fluorite for my collection. But what was it that got you into starting up something like that? Because I love curio shops, and especially places that sell, like, you know, old school toys, things like that, which y'all have in abundance over there.
Well,
so
that's true.
Tell us about it.
First of all, I've been a collector of the odd my whole life. Mm. You know, as far back as I can remember, if it looked interesting or different or whatever, classic but not overdone, I would find it, take it home.
Yeah.
But I believe the universe works in mysterious ways. And 7 months ago, you would have never caught me over here in Mineola doing anything.
Mm.
But through a strange series of events, I came over here, ended up running the theater, and then the annex, and then I was walking down the street, and the guys that were over there were moving out, and the owner was there, and I said, hey, what are you going to do with this place? He said, I have no idea. Do you want it?
Wow.
And I said, yeah. And
I do.
The next day, I said, I'm putting in a curio shop there. Let's do it.
Heck yeah, man. Yeah. Good for you for making it happen, because I think not enough people have that confidence in theirself to really put forth and make their dream occur, you know. So good. What was it that brought you to Mineola to begin with?
Well, I had decided that, first of all, the theater itself is haunted. It's 102 years old, oldest continuous operating theater in Texas, some say in the South in general. Hmm. And I did a couple of ghost hunts over there and was fascinated by it. And then I decided to do a film festival over there. And at that time, the executive director had dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me to take over, and I told them no four times. On the fifth time, they literally got down on their knees and said, George, would you please? And I was like, well, okay. And so that was it. Next thing you know, I'm loving it. I'm just loving it. I'm loving doing this.
That's
and everything
beautiful.
Else. And now I'm moving over here.
That is really great, man. You know, just to hear the fact that, hey, like you said, one of the longest-running theaters in the state of Texas,
mm-hmm.
To begin with, and then also haunted, mm-hmm. like you said. Myself and Dancer, my technician over here, are staying at the Beckham Hotel.
Oh, I've investigated the Beckham three times. It's fantastic.
It is a really, really interesting property. It's really cool. No experiences for us last night.
Did nobody got in bed with you?
Nobody got in bed with me. Not that I'm aware of.
What floor are you on?
I'm on the third floor.
That's the one.
I know.
Oh,
I know. Yeah, we are facing the train station.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I went for the Queen Suites. I was like, this is where the big folks would stay. This is where the people who came through town regularly, the barons, things like
there's
that.
There's a woman spirit up there that would like you a lot.
Okay. All right. What's her name?
I can't remember, actually. Okay. I think it was Dolly, but I'm not sure.
All right.
Yeah, they were
telling us about the telephone booth suicide, mm-hmm. things like that last night. I'm getting ready to have hopefully the owners on the show mm-hmm. to talk a little bit about it and the renovation, because it's really great to see what they've done over there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic place.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. Well, what was it that got you into the world of the paranormal to begin with, much less running a paranormal convention?
Well, since I was about 2 or 3 years old, I saw things that I tried to tell my parents about that they told me wasn't there.
Mm.
And I had two imaginary friends that were stoners.
All right.
Yeah. Not everybody tells you that story, I bet. But, yeah, I was too young to know what that was. But, yeah, they were like, yo, little dude, you're cool. You're going to go far. Do this, man. You rock.
Go, man.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm 3 and 4 years old going, yeah, I rock. You know, I don't know what the heck was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I saw them just like I'm looking at you now.
Yeah.
You know, and believe it or not, one of them's name was Doobie.
Okay. My son's is Mouse.
Yeah?
My son's is Mouse.
Yeah.
And I am one of those parents that I ask him what he talks to Mouse about. You know, like, I do not discount Mouse. Because I don't know, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
You know, at the time, I was sure that they were just part of the real world. Everybody knew that they were there. I even knew where they had lived.
Yeah.
And then later on, my parents were like, those were your imaginary friends.
What? Wow.
Doobie and Dobby didn't come visit me?
Wow.
Nope.
Pretty wild, man.
I know.
And has this been something that carried on throughout your life? Is this something that goes on now?
Yes, it's gone on since I was little, seeing things and hearing things that other people can, sometimes even receiving messages for others. And
oh, wow.
I call myself a psychic intuitive because it's not like I speak to the dead, per se, but if I took the time and focused in on you, I could tell you a lot about yourself and maybe some things that have gone on in your life that you wouldn't think that I would know that might help you.
Wow. Wow. I had a really good friend, Rocky Paul Morneau, in Maine, who was in Reader's Digest for like being struck by lightning by like 3 times in his life and living. And he had the touch like that. It was really interesting. He was an energy healer, and his knuckles would turn green whenever he was holding somebody's hand that needed help. It was the wildest thing in the world. And my wife was never really a believer in such things. She's the skeptic. But man, when we went to Portland, Maine, to we went up just to see her mom in York, and went to visit an old friend of mine. He was like, "Well, Rocky would like to meet you. You know, y'all have talked on the phone numerous times." And whenever he would call, he'd call me up and goes, "Hey, man, Rocky wants to talk to you." It was one of those just be quiet until Rocky stopped talking, and sometimes it'd be 2 hours.
Right.
He'd just be reading you over the phone, and it was the most fascinating thing in the world. And when my wife met him, oh man, like it was 180 degrees from her. She got chills.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, "I've never seen or experienced anything like that." Like he started telling her stuff about her. It was really wild, man. So I doubt nobody who has such abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it like for you to even walk into an environment like this? Because like I'm an anxiety sufferer, and sometimes for me, even though I ran rock and roll in clubs for 20 years, sometimes just like walking into a tavern just to have a beer at the end of the day or something, like the muddled vibration of a bar
it's
or a crowd of people
the
can
energy,
be rough.
Man, you know, and places like this, when it's what I consider my people.
Yeah, yeah.
The energy is high, and I can literally just get drunk off of it.
Yeah.
I can walk through the room and just soak it up.
Mm.
And I have to kind of shut myself down.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I start just, I get loopy.
Yeah. Yeah, mine, it's almost an exhaustion from having to block it out. Because sometimes, especially if I'm walking around Walmart or stuff like that, I'll hear people's conversations 30, 40 feet away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Footsteps will start taking on, like, rhythmic patterns, and it just becomes all overwhelming. So I can't even imagine. I mean, I'm somewhat empathic, but I can't imagine what it's like to be a psychic intuitive and walk into a situation like that.
Sometimes it's hard for me not to nail somebody, quote unquote.
Mm.
If I come past somebody or whatever and I get a certain sensation, I want to come over to them and go, "It's okay. Here's what you need to do."
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that because I don't want to scare them to death.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And even sometimes I'm sure sharing that experience with somebody, even if they're aware, can be tough.
It can be. You get one of three results. One is they're very grateful and they go on with their life. Two, you scare them and never see them again.
Mm.
Or three, they follow you around wanting more advice every day.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what was it that brought you into, was it just your involvement in the paranormal? Did you start doing clearings, paranormal investigations? What was it that brought you into the world of the paranormal and Bigfoot?
I was sitting in the middle of my floor when I was about 6 or 7 years old, playing with some blocks or something, and my mom said, "George, what do you want to do when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to be a paranormal investigator." And this is about 1975.
Wow.
No one knew what that even was.
Yeah.
I didn't know what that was. It just came out of my mouth. And she said, "Well, I guess if you can make money at it, you can do it." And it's like it was meant to be. I have no idea.
Wow.
From that point forward, I've done all sorts of things in the paranormal world. I've gone out long before the TV shows were on, long before it was anything cool, quote-unquote.
Sure.
And investigated the deepest, darkest places I could find. Some of it was great, some of it was scary. I've seen so many things I couldn't even begin to tell you. You wouldn't believe me anyway.
Mm.
I've seen a lot. I've done a lot. And I had a premonition when I was very young that I was going to pass away when I was 55. And I'm almost there.
Oh, wow.
And so I've packed as much into my life as I possibly can.
All right.
Writing books, being on TV, being in movies, being...
Yeah.
You name it, I have done it. I've done more than most people can ever say they've done because I knew when my time limit was going to be up.
Yeah, yeah, man. And what's it like for you? Because I know I was probably 19, and I still vividly remember the dream of flying an airplane and remembering seeing myself crash and see the aftermath, like even my body in the casket, which is pretty uncommon. But it was a very waking dream for me and something that was very, very real.
So do you avoid planes?
No, no. I mean, I would fly like almost 30 weeks a year up until COVID.
Right.
All right. I far from avoid planes. But it's one of those, it was a stealing moment in my life. You know, it was one of those moments where it was a dream, but it wasn't a dream. And I didn't quite know what it meant, but I knew that it meant something and that I needed to pay attention to it. So, yeah, ever since that moment, I've always, like you said, tried to do as much as I could. If I saw something that I wanted to get involved in, I didn't really hesitate.
It's like a hunger or a drive. Yeah. I mean, you got to do it.
Yeah.
You got to get it. Even if it doesn't fit, try it.
Yeah.
You know, and then move on.
Yeah.
Or stay with it. If you like it a lot, do it twice.
Yeah. And I think on that note, I think what a lot of people miss out on is the fact of just starting down a road will sometimes take you down the branch that you're actively supposed to be on. Whether or not you're supposed to follow what you started with, that's just supposed to be the first step on the journey.
Agreed.
You know?
Agreed.
And it's really interesting how so many people, I think, really do, unfortunately, put themselves in that box.
Well, the world is set up
themselves.
To keep you in a box.
It is.
It's set up for you to get up, go to work, go home, eat, go to bed, do it again.
Yeah.
And it's hard to break that mold or that cycle to get out there and find what you want to do and make a living at it, be able to survive,
yeah,
and still do those things. That's the way the world is. It's meant to keep you as a sheeple.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely.
And most people are content with that.
Yeah, and I think also mixed with that is also just culturally, especially here in America, and something that I'm trying to drive into my son. He turns 5 here in just a few weeks, but here in the last 6 months has been the hard conversation whenever he's like, I need that. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Do you want that or do you need that?
Yeah.
Because you need water.
Mm-hmm.
You want a soda.
Right.
You need food. You want a treat.
See?
So, you know, kind of that whole idea of realizing that, yeah, you could do it if you pare back in your life a little bit. You know, like people asked me for years, like how I got all my audio equipment. And I was like, well, I quit smoking a pack of cigarettes a day.
Everything is a give and take.
And everything that I spent on cigarettes went to buy a microphone.
Yeah, what
went
is
to
buy your cables. Priority? What do you really
exactly,
want?
Yeah. Exactly. And how hard are you willing to work for it? Because I think a lot of people, even with shows like this, they want to do it. And I've got a very good friend of mine that's got a good horror convention in Houston that he started up. And he wanted to do it, and there wasn't really one that was happening. And the community just responded in kind, and now they come out like crazy. They do horror pop-ups, and they'll have hundreds and hundreds of people, like, with 4 or 5 days notice, and tons of vendors.
And that's what I've been working to build up, and I think I've been successful, and also to do right by other people.
Hey, man, I saw a lot of Comic-Cons come and go in Houston, and I'm here to tell you, seems like this is a fairly new event cycle here in this town. But for a town like this, like I was telling you before we started the broadcast, for the fact that there was a paranormal convention here last week, and there are this many people here for a Bigfoot convention this week that didn't necessarily travel here. There are a ton of locals that came in to check out vendors that bought tickets and everything else. So the fact that they are not festivaled out.
Right.
And then you got a race going on. Coming up, that's happening. You've got you're organizing the Celtic Fest coming up. Tell us a little bit about that, because that's always a fun one.
Well, people automatically associate it with the Renaissance Festival,
sure.
But that's not exactly what it is. It's a celebration of culture and history, specifically targeting the Scottish, the Irish, and the Welsh. 5 stages of live entertainment going on all day. Yes, we have the Highland Games going on.
You can't not have some kilt wearing and caber tossing.
And we have arts and crafts and stuff for the kids, and we have vendors of all shapes and sizes, and we have everything from storytelling to history lessons to dancing and singing to, I mean, you name it. It's out there all day long, $10 for adults.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep, $5 for kids to get out there and just have fun all day long.
And really, once again, to see a small town Texas like this respond in such a reverberant way to these events, it's just beautiful. It really is. Like, it warms my heart so much to see a community built within a community.
Well, I can tell you there's something special about Mineola, Texas.
There really is, man.
I don't know what it is. The people here are wonderful.
Yeah.
The place is wonderful. The whole place has this movie-style vibe.
Yeah.
It's like you're walking into a movie set and everybody's on cue.
Yep.
I can't explain to you how wonderful it is.
You know, it really is interesting, because even sitting at the bar at the Beckham last night and just watching people come in and out and watching how they respond to people, because it's still run very much like a boarding house.
Yep.
Like, it was one of those, like, hey, just so you know, we lock the door at 11. If you need to come in later, give us a call and we'll come down.
Yep.
But, you know, like, they made coffee for us this morning, all kinds of stuff. And even going on the backside of the Select Theater here is a gas station. My technician and I went to go grab some cash for vendors and stuff like that. And this guy walked in, and the lady behind the counter was like, hey, how you doing? Welcome. And he, from New Mexico, he's like, you know, I do not remember the last time somebody welcomed me into a store.
Right.
And it's like a gas station.
Right.
He was like, that. Wow, thank you.
And even in the middle of the night, we'll be sitting outside in front of the theater or whatever on benches, and people are still strolling along, yeah, holding hands.
Oh, man, this place was kicking until at least 11 o'clock last night.
Absolutely.
It was pretty wild, even to see, even in this small town, to see how many taverns had popped up, mm-hmm, things like that. Just talking to the folks at the Beckham about how much nightlife has started happening around here. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's just a great place with great people, and I'm proud to soon call it home.
Well, I'm sure that they are more than proud to have you over there running the Select. How have things been over there? How long has it been? It's one of the longest running continuous.
Correct.
So it's never actively been out of service.
No, I mean, there was a brief moment of time during COVID where we couldn't do much.
Sure. I don't think anybody counts those.
I don't think so either.
But otherwise, COVID doesn't count toward
it's
records.
Been constantly going, doing movies, plays, stand-up comedy, live bands, you name it. I book it all, bring
that
it all
in
through
there. That is great, man. That is absolutely awesome.
That's a fantastic place to work. Yeah. So much fun. Something new every week.
Absolutely, man. And once again, bringing some really, really great stuff to a local community. You know, I mean, just, it blows my mind that this is Mineola, Texas.
I know.
It really does.
I'll just wait. I've got three of these buildings here. Oh, maybe that one, too, down there.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know. How about an axe-throwing building? We could all have beer and axes. What do you think of that? Somebody would probably die, but then we could hunt them paranormally.
That's right. There's nothing like adding a new stop to the tour.
Absolutely.
Your insurance won't love it, but your sales will skyrocket.
Yes.
With that in mind, actually, what is next? What are you looking at doing next?
Well, if everything goes according to plan, I'm going to try to put in a Christmas light park out here.
Oh.
Somewhere just outside of town, but it's not going to be like one that you drive through.
Yeah.
It's going to be about that size, but it's going to be a walkthrough with activities and things you can stop and do the way. Where you can, you know, the kids can stop and actually go and talk to Santa Claus or Mrs. Claus. Mrs. Claus can read them a story out of a book. They can go over here and listen to this person singing or do Christmas karaoke. And as they go, there's something different until they get back around to the end of the trail. But also, there's all the beautiful lights and everything everywhere.
Wow.
That's what I'm working on.
That's great. That is great. And once again, just a real, real great way to bring Mineola alive and bring people from outside of Mineola to Mineola.
Well, a secret for me is I've always liked to provide entertainment for people, especially families and for kids and folks that can't really afford a whole lot.
Yeah.
I try to give them memories.
Absolutely.
Because I grew up as poor as dirt.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I can ever say that I took with me out of all that was the good memories.
Yep.
The things that I cherish the most are those memories, and that's what I want to do for other people.
That's it. You know, and just to loop back to what we were talking about a minute ago, getting to that point of realizing what you want, what you need. You know, and realizing that you may want a lot of things, but that's what you need, and that's what families need, you know. Probably one of my biggest blessings over the last 2 years amongst COVID was the fact that I was not on the road 30 weeks a year as my son grew from 3 to 5. That point where he really does identify himself and become himself now, and I would have missed that. I would have not been there for that. Mm-hmm. So as horrible and weird and crazy as it sounds, I kind of thank God for being able to be there.
No, absolutely.
You know,
right.
It's really weird. It's strange, but it's one of those, like, it provided me an opportunity that I otherwise literally would not have had.
And that's one of the things, one of the reasons that I do the things I do as well is because I have a daughter. Mm. She's 21 now. She actually just got married.
Congratulations, Pop.
But I've done these things that she can be a part of.
Yeah.
And I've let her, anything that she wanted to be a part of, you know, even if she wanted to set up her little table and sell lemonade.
Absolutely.
You know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've encouraged that sort of thing. And now she's doing her own events.
That's great.
Yeah, she does the Tyler Area Vampire Ball.
Oh, wow. All
and
right.
And she does the Mineola Bridal Show.
Oh.
And, you know, stuff like that. She's doing her own thing, and they're successful.
That's great. Because
she's grown up watching me do it.
And that's just it. There's nothing like setting that example and passing it on, really. You
it
know,
makes me very proud.
It's a family business.
It
it's
does.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Man. That's beautiful. That is really, really great to hear. Do you have a website where people can go help set up events,
you
anything
know,
like that?
I did have toursoftyler.com because mm-hmm. that was my original business, but we've had so many other businesses that we've merged together. So now it is Jericho Co-Productions because Jericho is my nickname.
All right.
We don't have a website for that yet, but almost every event and thing that I have is on Facebook.
Yes.
By name.
Yeah.
Tyler Celtic Fest, the Paranormal Con, it's all on there. Or if you can just find me.
Absolutely.
Yep. George Jones, I'm on there, and then my picture is a wolf howling to me.
And he responds, I'm here to tell you. Like, we chatted back and forth, things like that. I called you on the phone. Mm-hmm. Like, you picked up. We talked about sponsorship for your show for a minute or two. You were busy at the Select, and I was busy at show in Houston. And
running back and forth.
Absolutely.
We got
but
there. Here I am.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I love meeting folks like you that are out there putting things like this, bringing communities together, and really, really passing that forward to the next generation.
Well, since you're here, there's something that I've really been wanting to talk to you about.
What's that?
Are you aware about your car's extended warranty?
Yes.
That's what this is all about.
Yeah,
actually.
The whole thing.
Was just to get you here to ask you that question.
That's right. It was funny because when they were doing the Bigfoot calling contest, I was going to go out and mine was going to be to actually call Bigfoot, like on my phone.
Yeah. Mine was going to be to go out there and go, hello, Bigfoot.
Yeah.
I've got a female nude Bigfoot here.
Hello.
Come on over.
Yeah.
You know. Date night.
Well, when can we look for a book from you?
Well, there's a few of them that are out there, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
There may be, I think the first run sold out, but Haunted Tyler and Beyond is out there. You might be able to still find it on Amazon. I'm not sure if it's sold out or not. And then Haunted Southern Texas is out there as well. And then I've got several short stories that are horror or science fiction that are available on for Kindle.
Oh, fantastic.
On Amazon and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm working on a new one.
Oh.
Yes. That deals with astral travel and the sharing of energy.
Oh.
Because I believe that people have two conversations. We're talking face-to-face. But our spirits are also communicating.
Oh, absolutely.
Getting vibes.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out all kinds of stuff.
We whenever you're ready and you have it ready, make sure to come back on the show because we talk about astral travel, NDEs, stuff like that regularly with folks like, you know, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge, all that. And it's really interesting that you bring that up because astral travel is a hot topic for me. I used to do a lot of dream work. And I was at the point where I could feel the fall coming on, you know, like that falling sensation just before you wake up. And
you don't want to get into this now.
Yeah.
I can feel a whole story.
I know. That's
especially
what I'm saying.
Especially when I start throwing in the time travel with the astral.
Ooh, yeah. And that's just it. I definitely want to, because the last time we were talking about it, it was in the slice of remote viewing. You know, looking at astral travel in the world of remote viewing and how they're so similar.
I can tell you some stuff that will definitely expand your mind.
We will definitely have you back on again and again, George. It's been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for taking the time on this very, very busy. I'm really, really impressed with how many people have been coming through all of this.
Oh, it's been fun.
It is really fantastic, man. Congratulations.
Thank you guys have
gone together and put together a great, great event. We should be getting ready here in just a second for a quick break. But
okay. Your partner promised me $100 for this, so if I can get that now.
Yeah, it's right here.
Is that actually $100?
There you go.
Oh, thank you. All right.
I keep stacks of them everywhere. So
I know. You keep them.
Don't worry about
it. I appreciate
that. Yeah, it's all right. If you see some roaming around, they're probably mine. Just bring them back.
Marilyn Monroe was on the 100, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, she was.
Good, that's what I was hoping for.
The skirt up picture.
Yep.
once again, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
I look forward to having you back on again and again and again, George.
Anytime you want, bro.
While you're online checking out all the great books and everything else from our guests today, make sure to stop on by the Facebook page of Southeast Texas Bigfoot. Make sure to stop on by the Facebook page, the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Roadshow, Tyler Paracon as well, the Tyler Celtic Festival, hopefully the upcoming Tyler or Mineola Christmas
Fest. It's coming.
All that. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back with you here in just a couple of minutes with a few more guests. We have a whole full roster. So we'll see you in just a few minutes, folks. We'll be right back. And welcome back to our continuing live coverage here at Curious Realm of the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Festival. We have been here with some incredible guests today. We had King Gerhardt, cryptozoologist extraordinaire, up here at the beginning of the show. He had a great presentation a while ago. We had Charlie D. Perez from Paranormal and Plastic up here showing off some fantastic, fantastic artwork, which I have bid on. Hopefully I win more tchotchkes for the studio background. I got some great stuff over here from our good friend Craig Woolheater. I got my little Yeti guy. Craig, how
you
doing,
sir?
My friend?
Good to see you.
Great to finally meet you in person, man. We have had you on the show a few times. I have sponsored your upcoming Folk Monster Festival, the upcoming Texas Bigfoot Festival, Texas Bigfoot Film Festival, another one in the cooking that I don't know if you're announcing yet or not, but
Texas UFO Con.
Well, I guess you are announcing. Man, I can't wait for that.
Coming up in November in Jefferson, Texas.
Wow. And, we were just talking up here with George Jones a minute ago about how exactly successful this great event is here. Once again, I was really, really impressed with the fact that just last week they had the Tyler Paranormal Convention, and Mineola, showed out in force for this. Really, really incredible to see the backup of a local community behind events like this.
Sure. I mean, and people come from all around. I don't know how many states people came from, but I'm sure surrounding states of Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, I mean, we're not far from the border of all those states here.
Yeah, and that's just it, especially right up here. This is the big thicket area. This is where most of the sightings in Texas occur, is up around this area, up around this tri-state area where the three really come together and touch, right. Which is why you have, of course, the Folk Monster Festival, named after the famous folk monster. All kinds of things. And once again, really, really great to see a community come out from all over and even here locally come out and support like this.
Sure.
Now you are, at least to me, one of the first cryptozoologists that I ever found. It was something for me when I found you that, it was a whole new world of knowledge for me.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you had Crypto Mundo was new, all that kind of stuff. Man, what has it been like for you to see a scene like this grow? To see more researchers coming about?
Well,
that kind of stuff.
To me, I really enjoy the camaraderie, the networking. These are great events for people, wanting to meet other people that are interested in the subject. And, I've always told people, even when I was doing active field work, that over 50% of this is the camaraderie. I mean, there's nothing better than hanging out with people, a group of like-minded people with a common interest. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, being able to sit back and talk about a topic unabashedly and, well, really unashamedly without somebody ridiculing you,
right,
questioning your belief, or even like we were saying earlier with King Gerhardt, just the fact of sitting back and culturally having the conversation, mm-hmm, with other people, you know.
I agree.
And even the fact of, like I was saying, his father, who is a scientist, being proud of his research.
Same with my father. My father was a physics professor.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he was based on, you know, hard, repeatable evidence.
Yeah.
But, you know, he, you know, I've been doing this a long time, you know, publicly since 1999. Started hosting a Texas Bigfoot Conference in 2001. And, you know, I've started, you know, adding more events. I just recently moved to Jefferson, which is the Bigfoot capital of Texas.
Yes, it is.
I wrote the town proclamation myself in 2017.
Yep.
And 2018 got, you know, the mayor finally signed it. You know, they've erected a life-size Bigfoot statue placed there by the Chamber of Commerce. And most of the restaurants have a Bigfoot burger or a Bigfoot barbecue sandwich, or, and, you know, several of the retail establishments are, you know, carrying a lot of Bigfoot souvenirs and T-shirts and stuff. Mm. So it's, you know, it's really been embraced. I mean, I've received, you know, three town proclamations, actually. In 2005, it was proclaimed that the third weekend in October in Jefferson was Texas Bigfoot Weekend.
Oh, wow.
And I was presented with that proclamation as well as a key to the city.
Wow.
So then in 2016, they issued a proclamation in observance of the 15th anniversary. Like I said, in 2018, the proclamation of Jefferson being the Bigfoot capital of Texas. And, you know, just last October, we held our 20th anniversary event in Jefferson. So, you know, I'm expanding events. I've moved to Jefferson now, so I'm planning to host, you know, an event a month. I host, you know, car club events, car shows, but most of it is, you know, cryptozoology related.
Yeah.
I've got another event coming up in September that's going to be a crossover from Bigfoot to paranormal investigation, a group of a female team. Paranormal investigators, but they've recently, well, 7 years ago or so, branched out into Sasquatch investigation.
Oh, wow.
From, you know, in the Fargo, North Dakota area, are coming down to do some Bigfoot stuff and also to have an overnight paranormal investigation at the historic haunted Jefferson Hotel in Jefferson. And then I'm, like you mentioned, I'm starting up a Texas UFO con in November in Jefferson. I have the Texas Bigfoot Conference in October. In December, I have the Bigfoot Film Festival in Marshall. So, you know, it's really been embraced in, you know, over north, far east Texas. You know, the majority of the Bigfoot reports in this state take place in the eastern one-third of the state where there's an abundance of rainfall, precipitation.
Mm.
An abundance of cover and an abundance of food source. And, you know, that's where, you know, all the wild animals congregate. You know,
yeah.
If they're, you know, if they're real animals, creatures, whatever you want to say, they need food, cover, and water. And if you have those three things in abundance, you have an abundance of wildlife.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if it's Bigfoot related, then there's an abundance of food source. For, you know, whatever the Bigfoot may be eating, you know, plants, fish, yeah, turtles, deer, wild stock, you know, livestock from local farms. So, you know, it's, there's ample territory, you know, in the four state region of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, and they all come together, all four, and that's,
yep,
a concentration of forest land. There is, I believe in the four-state region, there is 100,000 square miles of forest land,
wow,
which is bigger than the size of the entire state of Oregon.
Yeah,
of forest land in the four states. And like I said, when you've got that with abundant rainfall, water source, and you know, other food
sources, supplies,
right,
yeah,
you know, you're going to have animals. I mean, we have black bear, we have you know, wild hogs, we have all kinds of, you know, even big cats, you know, mountain lions,
yep,
are seen here in this four state region. So I mean, if it can support those animals, it could easily support a Bigfoot.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think something that we were talking about with King Gerhardt a while ago that a lot of people, I think, slips their mind whenever you're talking about trying to find a species like that, mm-hmm, that kind of stuff, is that the home range of even the average species, whenever you're talking about a cougar, a bear, it can be miles.
Oh,
it,
yeah,
can be miles.
Miles,
so,
miles.
So, you know, trying to find where it beds down or where it's eating, that kind of stuff.
Well, I liken it to, you know, not even looking for a needle in a haystack. You're looking for a moving needle in a whole field of hay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in the Pacific Northwest, the last count that I knew of, there were 72 aircraft that had crashed in the forests, redwoods and forests of the Pacific Northwest that have not been found.
Yeah.
That's 72 airplanes.
And those things have transponders.
And those things are not moving.
Yeah.
And they're made of metal.
Yeah.
And they can't find,
yeah,
them.
And we know a last known direction, last known altitude, last known speed. So and figuring out a path of where,
right,
it should be,
you know,
should not be rocket math.
You know, people think that, you know, humans have covered every square inch,
yeah,
of territory in the United States,
yep,
North America, and it is just not the case.
Yeah, and, it, you know, it's interesting because the first time that I had you on the show was when the proclamation happened.
Yes, sir.
For Jefferson. And every time you've been on our show, we were even talking about it with King Gerhardt earlier, I always show the map of the United States at night as taken from the space station.
Right.
And granted, you know, the most recent, I think, that NASA has posted is probably about 5 years ago. But even 5 years ago, whenever you look at the map of the U.S. at night, from about halfway over, from the edge of Texas over, is dark at night.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does, like you're saying, illustrate how much wild territory there is out there, especially, mm-hmm, in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
There's even been the reporter that started doing the Missing 411 series.
Right.
Which has been incredibly popular in just the fact of there are so many people and strange instances within our national parks that they can't even find, people,
right,
that go missing, things like,
sure,
that. So, yeah, yeah, really, really wild stuff abounding within those nature preserves, things,
mm-hmm,
like that. Now, in your literal over 20 years of research in this field, Craig, what has been some of the standout moments for you and things that you have investigated or cases that have come across your table?
Well, you know, I've probably talked to over 300 people. And that have claimed that they've seen, you know, one of these animals, creatures, beings, whatever you want to say. And, you know, there's only a couple possibilities as far as I'm concerned, you know. Either they're lying about it, somebody could have hoaxed them, they could have been under the influence of narcotics or alcohol.
Sure.
They could be mistaking known wildlife or a person.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other possibility I see is, or they saw what they say they saw.
Yeah.
And if even one of those people is telling you that, then, you know, there's something out there.
Yeah.
And I have my own experience from Louisiana in 1994 where I saw something no more than 20 feet from my vehicle at night on the side of the road that I can't explain away. So, you know, if I threw out everything I've ever talked to anybody, you know, I have my own experience that I can't explain away. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And at that point, it's one of those, like, you, I don't know, you seem like a pretty sane individual, Craig, through the conversations that we've had privately and on air. Just as with any whistleblower or anything like that, until proven otherwise, I tend to believe your eyewitness account.
Well, you know, the thing to me, and I don't typically use the word belief because that's taking something on faith.
Yes.
You know, I think that the evidence points to these things being there.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it'd be far harder to believe that every footprint track that's been seen and cast and every eyewitness sighting is a hoax.
Yeah.
Or mistaken identity than it is to take the preponderance of evidence into consideration that points to, you know, something is there.
Yeah. Yeah, and even if you're talking the preponderance of anecdotal evidence.
Sure.
You know, even the preponderance of stories that are out there. Because one of the things that we talk about regularly on the show is crop circles. And, of course, people bring up hoaxed crop circles.
Right.
It's like, okay, yeah, there are hoaxes. And a lot of modern hoaxes, a lot of modern, you know, artists
Dave.
Out there doing things like that.
Doug and Dave.
Yeah, yeah. And but it's also one of those, the stories of the devil circles in England go back to the 1500s. They go back to the time of the Black Plague. And you know what they didn't really have a whole lot of time to do in the Black Plague?
Make fake crop circles
or destroy half a field of crop.
Yeah.
You know, you would have been driven out of town.
Right.
And when you're talking about people in the 1800s, things like that, that have anecdotal sightings where they were in newspapers, that kind of stuff. It's hard to dismiss that because they had something better to do.
Sure.
Than to fake that or to try to sensationalize that you saw something.
And here in North America, the Native American legends and lore go back hundreds and hundreds of years that they accepted them as another tribe that lived in the woods.
Yeah.
And some tribes, you know, even, I wouldn't say traded with them, but left food offerings for them.
Yes.
But some tribes avoided them at all costs and said that, you know,
they were dangerous.
To see one was a death omen, you know. So there's been, you know, all kinds of, legends and lore dating back hundreds of years, you know, certainly before, the Patterson-Gimlin film came out and in 1967, or the famous Bigfoot tracks that where the name Bigfoot was coined from 1958 in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, even here in the South, you know, Bigfoot was not used. I mean, people, you know, it was the boogeyman or the wild man of the woods or whatever. It wasn't associated with Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And those go back hundreds of years.
Yeah. And especially now, even regionally, whenever you're talking about sightings, things like that, they tend to take on different names. You know, Skunk Ape. Visit Australia and it's the Yowie.
Yeah. I mean, here in the South, I mean, you know, you can come across most rural communities and if they have a creek, they got a monster that goes with the creek, the Turkey Creek Monster, you know, all of these different, you know, the Chambers Creek Monster, you know, these are just several that, you know, in Northeast Texas that have communities where there's creatures been sighted and you know, when you get out to areas like, you know, out here in Far East Texas, you know, when you talk about this stuff, you know, it's a good chance that somebody that you may be talking to, you know, didn't personally have an encounter, but have a friend or a family member that has seen something and has told them about it. You know, and a lot of stories don't even get told because people are afraid of being ridiculed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. That's the one thing that we bring up regularly on the show is that a good 70% of the time,
at least.
It is not within the person's vested interest to come forward with a UFO story, with an abduction story, with the story of a out-of-body experience or NDE, or even a Bigfoot encounter. Because, like you said, most people would be ridiculed.
Yeah, I mean, I've had people from all walks of life, all occupations, you know, submit a report with their name and phone number attached. And, you know, if from clergymen to law enforcement to military, you know, I can see no motivation for them to submit a report saying they've seen one of these things and attach their name and phone number to it.
Yeah.
What could be the motive? You know, if it became public, you know, they'd be laughed out of town probably.
Well, and that's something that I was going to bring up because you come from the DFW area, Dallas-Fort Worth. I mean, the first articles of the Lake Worth Monster, what really spurred you into looking into this as a youth.
From 1969.
And do you find that
just in general that people are more receptive within communities like out here in Mineola, folk, stuff like that in Arkansas, as opposed to the larger cities?
Well, yeah, because like I said, you know, you run into people that may be interested in and may have a friend or family member that's had an encounter or seen something. So, you know, being receptive to it, then, you know, somebody who lives in a high rise in Dallas, you know, maybe not, you know, is not interested. It doesn't, you know, it's not relevant to their life.
Yeah, but, I mean, probably not a whole lot of chance to see a squatch strolling through Deep Ellum.
Sure. And, and you know, there's
Deep Ellum.
I lived there for 7 years, so I know what you mean.
You see all kinds of things.
You see all kinds of things. But you know, out in East Texas, again, where these areas where there's abundant wildlife, you have hunters out in the woods, deer hunters.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a large subset of people that, you know, have had an encounter.
Well, and people that are also, many of them, lifelong experienced in tracking and being able to go out and sit under a tree and track game, not necessarily standing in a blind all day looking for a deer. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a skill set there, and especially an experience in the field that, you know, much like depending on any airline pilot who is a trained observer and has thousands of hours in the air, those guys have thousands of hours their whole life on the ground with the native wildlife and the native fauna and everything. So a report from them, I think really does bring a little bit more credence to it than, just say a city slicker coming out and seeing something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, I've talked to hundreds of people over the years, and I feel a portion of those are, you know, being honest, weren't hoaxed, you know, or describing something that actually happened to them.
Now, how do you, because I'm actively working on something right now, and I've got an episode in the can that I can't even release until I vet it and literally vet the person. That's how bombastic it is. Just because of legal reasons, it's mind-numbing.
Right.
How do you vet a case? How do you vet a person? How do you vet a story?
Well, you know, you ask them the same question different ways to see if their story is consistent.
Sure.
If, you know, if their story doesn't change, if the details, you know, what time of night did this happen, you know.
Sure.
What was the weather conditions? You can look that up. Somebody tells you it happened on such and such night, and there was a full moon out. Well, you can go back.
Yeah, that's not rocket math. That's a Google.
And look at that. But, you know, again, you know, you have to listen with a skeptical ear. You know, like I said, what's the motivation for somebody that's a professional person or law enforcement to attach their name to report when, you know, we offer, you know, anonymity, but, you know, they don't know that for a fact that their name is not going to be attached and on the internet that they saw a Bigfoot. I mean, and, you know, I just don't know what their motivation would be to take that chance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm, you know, once again, that's a big part of it, to consider the fact of they really have no vested interest, even the interest of, okay, so I'm going to have a book shadow written, whatever. Like, the process behind that is a process in and of itself.
Right.
You know, and the likelihood of that panning out to the extreme is pretty extreme in and of itself.
Sure.
So, man, I want to thank you, Craig, for a lifetime of work
thank
in this
you.
Field, a lifetime of research. And
you know, I just started out as somebody that something had a strange encounter and, you know, I wasn't a woodsman. I wasn't an outdoorsman. I wasn't a hunter, but I was curious enough to go out into the woods and do those kinds of things to try and get answers. And, you know, I've gotten some answers, but I got far many more questions, you know, from doing it. And, you know, it's been an adventure. And, you know, my organization was officially, it's coming up this year, will be 23 years that it's been in existence. And like I said, last year was my 20th anniversary conference in Jefferson. And, you know, and I'm, you know, adding more events. I'm not slowing down. you know, it's, you know, Jefferson is a tourist town, and now I'm a resident there. My parents lived there since 98, and so I enjoy bringing tourists to town because that town depends on it, you know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's only a little over 2,000 people, and, you know, it depends on tourism and mostly on the weekends. So,
absolutely.
You know, whatever I can do to help the community, I give just this year I awarded for Jefferson High School seniors. I awarded 11 scholarships.
Wow.
For Jefferson for this for the next the fall semester of college. And in Falk I do the same thing, and I just sent the paperwork in yesterday to the counselor at Falk High School. This year, every student that applied for the Texas Bigfoot Scholarship or the Falk Monster Scholarship, I awarded every student a scholarship. Usually
wow.
I pick, but I awarded 8 in Falk and 11 in Jefferson this year. So 19 high school students are going to get funding for their education, you know, by Bigfoot, basically.
That is incredibly awesome, man.
So, I believe in giving back to the community.
That's right.
They've embraced it.
Yep.
And trying to come up with a way to give back and pay it forward. And,
yeah.
You know, if a kid can go to college and you know, buy his books with money from the Falk Monster, I mean, that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah. And if anything, whenever, you know, you're sitting around doing what college students do in their dorm and you're talking about how you got here and everything, I'm on an academic. Well, you know, I'm here on baseball. What about you? Well, I'm here because of Bigfoot.
Yeah. I got a Bigfoot scholarship. Falk Monster scholarship.
And what a conversation starter and what a way to literally bring that about to a whole new generation.
And I ask on the application that I made for the students, I have one line on there that says, you know, what does... You know,
but it's the folk monster mean to you.
Yes. Yeah. And so you get, you know, all kinds of responses from the students, you know, in Jefferson. What do you think about Bigfoot in East Texas? You know, what do you think about the Falk Monster? So
it's not like applying to Ghostbusters where you have to believe in the Loch Ness Monster, the theory of Atlantis.
No. So, like I said, I like to give back to the community. And this year, instead of just picking and choosing, because I normally pick, you know,
sure,
two
sure.
students from each batch, but,
wow.
you know, I was just like, you know, 11 kids submitted. Okay, we'll give it to 11 people. And in Falk, 8 people. Okay, we'll give eight out. I mean, they're not getting as much per person, but, you know, everybody that submitted, I figure everybody that had the courage to submit a scholarship application for a Bigfoot scholarship, what the heck? Give them all one.
Heck yeah.
So
what a great concept.
So that's what I did this year.
What a beautiful idea. Now, before we let you go, shameless self-promotion, when are things coming up? What are the dates for shows? Where can people go to buy tickets? Where can they go to buy their epic Folk Monster T-shirt? Because I've already gotten mine.
Right.
Got it in the mail. Fits great.
Looks great. You already got
it? The artwork looks fantastic.
That artwork is awesome, isn't it?
Oh, my God. It's beautiful. I should have brought it with me so that I can show it on camera.
But it is very cool artwork that I got commissioned this year. Everything is on Facebook. I mean, Facebook is ubiquitous these days. So the Falk Monster Festival is on June 18th in Falk, Arkansas. I've got an event coming up in Jefferson. I'm still working on the details, but it's a planned She Squatchers Come to Texas. It's a group of female paranormal investigators that started doing Bigfoot research, and they're doing an event in Jefferson with some Bigfoot presentations, but also an overnight paranormal investigation at the Haunted Historic Jefferson Hotel.
Nice.
That's in September. October 14th through 16th is the Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson. My new event, the Texas UFO Con, is going to be on November 19th, the Saturday before Thanksgiving. And then the Bigfoot Film Festival in Marshall at the historic, it's a beautiful theater. I'm brain dead.
It's all right.
Marshall City Hall performance venue.
There you go.
But it used to be City Hall through, I think, 1967, and they've recently
renovated
it into a performance venue where they have concerts and plays and operas. And it's like an old-time theater with the box seats on the side, the balcony and everything.
Oh, wow.
And it's awesome. And, you know, I'm waiting on, you know, firm confirmation from Bobcat Goldthwait to come screen Willow Creek. But I'm going to have some brand-new Bigfoot films that are likely to be premiering at the film festival.
Oh, wow.
So there's a couple of new those, and there'll be some older films. And hopefully we'll be screening Willow Creek with Bobcat. So
yeah.
That's what's going on, you know, through the end of the year.
Too cool, man. You have so much going on. You put so much into the community, and I think that is why you get so much out of it.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Anytime you are welcome, my audience
and
is your
appreciate
audience.
You for sponsoring my events.
Absolutely.
So you can broadcast live just like we're doing here and talk to people about their encounters. And
bring the message and the community to a larger audience and community,
sure.
And that's just it.
Yep.
I love, as I've told you before, my group is your group. Promote.
Very cool.
Put things on there. That's what the group is all about. So
cool.
Thank you very much for your time today. I know that we have people roaming through right now,
sure.
So I'll let you get back to your vending. But,
okay, thank you, sir.
We'll be back.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We will be back here in just a moment, folks, with more coverage. We're going to see if we can get Daniel Allen Jones up on air. We also have the amazing Jason McLean, author of Metroplex Monsters, coming up. We will be having Ryan Edwards come up. He is the author of Cryptids of the World. He is a cryptozoologist as well. So much more coming up live from the Folk Monster Festival. Folk Monster Festival. We aren't there yet. Craig's in my eyesight. Live from the Texas Bigfoot Roadshow here in Mineola, Texas. We'll be back here in just a minute, folks. Don't you go anywhere and stay curious. Back in just a minute. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more.
Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is PodcastCadet.com.
Howdy, welcome back to our last hour of continuing coverage of the 2002 Texas Bigfoot Conference. Chris Jordan here with the Curious Realm. Sorry about the abrupt out there, folks. Special thanks to our good friend and guest, Daniel Allen Jones. This is the artwork for his upcoming book, Aurora, Texas, 1897. This upcoming is the 125th anniversary of that incident. He's got an amazing book covering that and other cases in Texas. Thank you so much for the signed copy of your artwork, Daniel. That will be going up in the Curious Realm studio, as well as the book Cryptids of the World, from our guest right now, Ryan Edwards. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Nice to be here, guys.
Absolutely, man. Well, tell us a little bit about your book. Tell us a little about you, your research, everything you do.
Of course. My name is Ryan Edwards. I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. A little thing I like to say with my research in cryptozoology is that, you know, every little boy loves dinosaurs, loves mysteries, loves animals. I guess I just never grew out of that.
Yeah.
And I found a world of cryptozoology which kind of fits with everything. It's a little mystery, a little animals, a little paleontology, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it really is. It's a melange of stuff with cryptozoology, because it's not just Bigfoot. It's, as Nick Redfern was saying this morning, it's Littlefoot. It's you know, pygmies. There's so much rich folklore and history in that kind of stuff. So what was it that really brought you into the world of cryptozoology? What was it that really piqued your interest to begin with?
With me, I think the one memory I really have that really brought me into this world was one show on History Channel called Monster Quest.
Okay.
I think I was watching, I have this memory, it's so vivid. I think it was like 5 years old. I was on a couch in the living room, and it was Monster Quest playing, and there was a Thunderbird episode.
Oh, yeah.
And right when I think the bird flies over someone, I remember that, and I'm like, wait, monsters do exist. The world is bigger than it really is.
Yeah.
There's stuff out there that we haven't seen, or that we've seen and we don't know about.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, as we talked about with numerous guests here today, it's interesting to see the cultural anecdotal evidence amongst things like that, especially stuff like Thunderbirds. Those are in just about every Native American lore all over the country. There have been numerous sightings of them, even here in Texas. And not so much the Thunderbirds, but pterodactyls.
Yeah,
you know, pterodactyl sightings in Texas, things like that. So really, really wild, interesting things.
Yes. Like, a lot of people talk about cryptozoology. It's like, Sasquatch, Yeti, Loch Ness Monster. I'm like, yes, those things are super interesting, but it's just the surface.
Yeah.
It's like, cryptozoology really is like an iceberg. The tip of it's all the big names, but underneath it, it's so much more.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is a huge just gathering of stories, folklore, things like that. What are some, now, your book, Cryptids of the World, let's get into that a little bit. What are some of the topics that you get into in here? What was your favorite topic to cover in the book?
I think one of my favorite topics was a phenomenon known as proto-pygmies. You brought up Nick Redfern and his work with Littlefoot.
Yeah.
Proto-pygmies is what researchers like Lauren Coleman and Ivan Marks and Ivan T. Sanderson, they call these creatures proto-pygmies. Because what the sightings occur along the equatorial areas of across the world. In Africa, they go by the name of Gogui. And places like Indonesia, you have stories of the Orang Pendek.
Mm-hmm.
In South America, you have the Aleuts and the Didi. All these creatures have a very similar morphology and very similar behaviors. They're described as like almost like little men, but fur-covered. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of unbelievable, because a lot of people put it in the realm of like elves and leprechauns.
Yeah.
But there's physical evidence behind these creatures, like footprints and cultural history and cultural relativity between different tribes about these creatures. And recently, in the 1960s, of course, Lucy was found.
Yep.
And the idea of human evolution was brought up, and people were like, okay, we have stories of little hairy men, and this did truly exist. So what if these proto-pygmies are creatures like Australopithecus or Paranthropus that have survived into the modern day?
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And even within the last couple of years, the actual finding and possibility that there may still be living hobbits.
Yeah.
And on islands, things like that, actual skeletons being found. Even within the last year, Dragon Man. In China, where we're talking a cranial volume almost twice that of its Homo sapien cousins and stuff like that. And this, it's not a fake fossil. It's the only one of its kind. But it has been verified by numerous scientific things that, this man was 9 feet tall. And you know, to me, it brings up people like our guest L.A. Marzulli that we have to talk about giants, James Keenan, who does giant research, Brad Olson as well. These stories, even amongst Native American tribes, even amongst tribes in the Middle East, of red-haired giants that have been there for hundreds of years, the actual native people of the Southwest were told to stay out of the caves by their elders because, like, you will be eaten. They will come and eat you. These are stories that are amongst cultures the world over. Not just the pygmies, not just the Littlefoot, Bigfoot. It's really, really interesting.
Yes, like with a Sasquatch, it's kind of a cultural phenomena.
Mm.
It occurs all across the world, and a lot of people say, put that up to just something called anthropomorphism.
Sure.
Humans like to see ourselves in nature.
Oh, yeah.
But I believe not exactly, because there's so much evidence for it.
Yeah.
You have the Yeti of the Nepal. You have the Yeren of China, the Yowie of Australia, the Bukit Timah monkey man in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
And all of these sightings have very similar morphology and very similar behavior sets. So how are these people talking amongst each other if there's no communication? How are people in Australia talking about something that looks Bigfoot-like?
And if there was no trade amongst tribes at the time, and their stories go back that far, especially whenever you're talking about Yowie, things like that, like those are stories from the Aboriginal people, and as opposed to Native Americans, things like that, we know that the Aborigines trace their lineage back to literally the first men, you know, so to know that for literally thousands of years of spoken history, this has been their history.
Yes.
That these things live around Rainbow Rock. You know, it's really, really wild to, once again, discount these most of the time. And for me, myself, it's one that, as I say all the time, I'm more prone to believe people that have been telling the story for hundreds of years, and it's an accepted part of their culture.
Yes, like that's one thing with me and cryptids. I look at the culture. If the indigenous population has stories of these creatures, the likelihood of them existing is very high.
Yeah.
If there's no indigenous stories and it just came around when the white man came around,
yeah, yeah,
then it's probably just a cultural idea that's brought with them.
Or it could even be something that, you know, tribal elders came up with in order to scare them off.
Yes. Like I know, for instance, to take the Wendigo phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
The Wendigo, original Native American description, something more like what we now know as like the rake, or like very skinny humanoid white skin.
Yeah.
Modern day descriptions of like a antlered deer-like animal, that only came around when Anglo-Saxons came into North America. And yeah, they brought their stories of werewolves came, and the stories of the Wendigo mixed with it, and now we have a yeah, modern interpretation.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. We have the shapeshifter.
Yeah.
Creature that we have that's almost like a skinwalker to an extent.
Yes.
And like you said, very, very much in the world of lycanthropy and werewolfism, the accounts come to now as opposed to the traditional accounts. And now, in your research, what kind of things, of course, have you found here in Texas? Because, I mean, of course, you're talking about the world, but you're based out of San Antonio. So
yes.
What kind of research have you done in your own backyard for cryptids?
For instance, an eyewitness of mine talked to me about here in San Antonio, there's a place called Salado Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about weird howling and peculiar screams out here. And this is almost the middle of town.
Yeah.
And I talked to him, and I'm like, okay, could it be coyotes? And they're like, no, I had no coyote howls.
Yeah.
So I did an experiment. I had on YouTube, coyote howl, wolf howl, dog howl. Then I had, I think, American Werewolf in London howl. Played all four of them, and the only one that matched was one at the end.
Wow.
The American Werewolf in London.
Wow.
And what I did is I went out, little night investigation just to see what it is. The likelihood of it being a creature, it's low, like living in the area, but what I think is because it's a creek, it might use the creek as like a natural highway.
Mm-hmm.
Comes up from out of town, uses Salado Creek to get in, maybe hunts, does whatever it needs to along the creek.
Yeah.
And one thing that's also peculiar with it is that just down the road from where they had this phenomenon, this hearing, they didn't see the creature, they have the Black Swan Inn, which is one of the most haunted places in Texas.
Yeah.
Is there a correlation? Maybe, maybe not. Just because two things occur doesn't mean they're correlated.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Even if they occur within the same mile of each other, it doesn't mean that they're correlated. And that's a really, really good point to bring up, especially whenever you're talking sighting experiences, things like that. Our last conversation was with Craig Woolheater, and part of the conversation was, you know, how do you go about vetting a story? You know, how do you go about vetting somebody who's giving you an account whenever you're sitting down face-to-face like this even? Yes, I say on my show all the time, I am given to always believe the story until proven otherwise. That's just me. I myself have had my own experiences in life, spiritually, where people are like, yeah, okay, dude. So I understand that. I get that. So I'm always more prone to understand somebody's experience and want to understand their experience and how it changed them than to discount it. But with your experiences, especially in Solano Creek, what was it like for you to, I guess, go through the investigative process? Let's kind of walk through that a minute, because I think a lot of people, unfortunately, see TV shows.
Yeah.
And we talk about it regularly, especially in paranormal investigations, ghost hunts, things like that, where it's like, you know, should you be using a laser thermometer that's not actively measuring the temperature in the air? It's measuring the surface that it's touching.
Yeah.
You know, or should you be using an ambient room temperature, you know, and actively catch the temperature of the cold spot that you're feeling?
Yes.
You know, it's one of those, even the... it's hard for me to bite, and I've heard a lot of EVP. It's hard for me to bite on fully digital EVP because the whole concept originally back in the 1910s, 1920s, when these experiments were carried out, was that the ghost or entities were able to manipulate the weak electromagnetic field of the record head. Hey, there's a lot of things that will affect the electromagnetic field of a record head.
Yes.
So I could see that. But to be able to affect the digital ones and zeros that are representing a sound that's being recorded.
It's a little bit harder to
It's a little bit harder for me to bite as an audio engineer.
Yes.
Like, that's what I do for a living. So, yeah, like, I'm not discounting it. I'm not saying that people haven't gotten them. I would just like to see the actual science behind that.
Yes.
You know.
Which, I'm the type of guy that I really want the science behind it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't discredit certain, like, paranormal phenomena and a little bit more out there ideas.
Sure.
But I am very much like, okay, physical, scientific, evolution, all these ideas.
Yeah.
But I don't discredit the other side either.
Sure, sure. And you know, that actually brings up a topic and a point of topic. When it comes to cryptids, especially, and especially when you're talking Bigfoot and other cryptids like chupacabras, frequent accounts bring them into paranormal.
Yes.
And, of course, paranormal is a catch-all term. It literally is exactly what it says, just like a UFO. It is exactly what it says until proven to be alien. Yes. It is an unidentified flying object. It's something that we don't know. So paranormal, yeah, it was something it's just outside of the normal. Norm. It's not something that happens to you Monday through Friday.
Yes.
You know, but there's a lot of tie, or a lot of people tying cryptids to the paranormal. And when I say paranormal, I mean UFO sightings, UFO abduction, portals, time travel,
orbs,
by location, things like that. You know, where do you stand on that as a researcher? Not personally, and of course not dissing anybody else's belief or their concept or their paradigm of these creatures. But where do you stand on that?
With me, not that I discredit the ideas of, like, people thinking Bigfoot comes out of portals or anything like that.
Sure.
It's a possibility. No one's an expert in this field.
Yeah.
But
we got to prove Bigfoot before we can prove the portal thing.
Yes. But with me, I just don't have a lot of volition into it. I don't put a lot of research into that type of aspect.
Sure,
because it's almost like trying to solve a mystery with another mystery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I like to say is, like, a saying in science is correlation does not mean causation. Just because two things are occurring doesn't mean they're causing one another.
Good friend Stephen Myers says that all the time.
Yes.
All the time.
Like, let's just say a person is having Bigfoot sightings on their property.
Yeah.
And at the same time, their house is haunted.
Yeah.
These might be two phenomena occurring in the same space, but they're not causing one another.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like if you're a kid and you clap your hands and there's thunder. You think, oh, I just made that happen. But with logic and you get older, you're like, okay, no, I did it. It just happened at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was a front coming through and I just happened to clap at the right moment.
Yes. Like, a lot of people say there's no such thing as coincidence, which I can understand that. But sometimes coincidence does occur.
Sure. Absolutely. It's not all synchronicity.
Yes.
You know, and even to the point that you made just a second ago of if you do. Let's just say that you are one of them that accepts the facts that the fact that Bigfoot or other cryptids come through portals, what have you. Now you have the actual an active question of now you're out in the field. Which equipment do you bring with you? Which ones do you break out? Do you start researching the portals?
Yeah.
Do you start researching the portal evidence first or the Bigfoot?
Yeah.
You know,
it's like it kind of brings in a whole.
It's like, a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah, it brings in a whole bunch of, like, wibbly-wobbly stuff in one just field. And it's like, I'm okay with the people that bring in those ideas into the field.
Sure.
But at the same time, it kind of muddies up the water.
And like I said, not just muddies up the waters in that way, but when you get out there, what research are you doing? What is the focus of the research? What evidence are you looking for? Because you're going to bring a whole different set of equipment with you to read for weak electromagnetic fields than you will to trap hair off a tree.
Yes.
Or, you know, things like that. So it really is that fact of, you know, you get a team like King Gerhard and Daniel Allen Jones out in the field. We got 25 hours in which to conduct some research, guys. What is our focus?
Yes.
What are we devoting time to? What are we devoting money and energy to?
Yeah, so you can have maybe like two teams and one specializes
sure.
in a certain thing, whatever person specializes. Yeah. But if you're out there looking for five different things, you're not going to find any of them because you're separating your time. You're not focusing on one certain aspect.
Yeah, it's the idea of a shotgun blast is powerful up to this.
Yes.
A rifle's going to carry you a whole lot farther.
Yes.
And it's a whole lot more accurate, you know.
Yeah.
So to take all your effort and focus it on one thing, you're probably a lot more likely amongst five people out in the field to find evidence for one thing than to find it for five
yes.
if your efforts are scattered.
Like, I know, I like to bring up with this, but Albert Einstein, he's an astrophysicist. He wasn't an astrophysicist, a biologist, an anatomist, a doctor, a this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he focused on one particular thing. A lot of scientists worry about one particular thing.
Yeah.
They don't have a shotgun blast in all
That's
these
right.
different fields. They might know a little bit of everything, but they don't specialize in all these fields.
That's right.
Because, heck, the human brain can only hold so much information.
Yeah.
And we can do only so much critical thinking.
Yeah, prime example, you go to your general practitioner, you got a back problem, he's going to send you to an orthopedic specialist because he is a general practitioner. What you need is a specialist.
Yes.
Now, with that being said, going out in the field yourself to do research, what's normally in your kit? What are you normally bringing along? What kind of evidence are you typically trying to gather?
With me, I try to come along with like anything for physical evidence, like... For instance, like if I do a Bigfoot research, I might do a plaster cast, like plaster with me.
Sure.
Of course, like anything that's, I like to say, anyone that wants to go out there and do research, think as if you're going to go out camping for a week.
Yeah.
Like anything you would bring, like survival gear, anything for like a tent, things like that, especially plan for the worst.
Yes.
Because a lot of people talk about survival situations. Don't let a Bigfoot hunt turn into a survival situation.
Yeah, man, don't go out for a 3-hour hike without a spare bottle of water with you, not just the one that you're drinking.
And know the area beforehand.
One
thing I do is I look at topographical maps. Like, okay, where's the hills? Where's the waterways?
Sure.
Worst case scenario, where can I go to know where there's people?
Well, even the thought, especially nowadays, I mean, of course, with our beautiful cell phones, we have things like last known location.
Yes.
You know, so if your cell phone dies, it's going to ping and let somebody know.
Or even have, like, a satellite phone with you.
Yeah, sure.
Like, heck, out here in East Texas, there's places where it's a dead zone. You won't get a signal. So if you have something like a satellite phone, you will always get a signal.
You'll always have a signal, precisely. And even the old school Boy Scout thing of like, hey, just let somebody know the direction you're headed, man.
Yes.
Like, I'm starting here. This is where I'm going. This is where you will find my truck parked, you know? Things like that. Because, it can really, you can get caught up in the moment. And no matter how well you plan, I mean, the worst could happen any moment.
And one thing I always say, too, is don't let emotions run high. Like, if you're on a research trip and let's just say you hear rustling in the bushes, you don't go chase after it or something like that.
Yeah.
You don't let your emotions take control of you. Always think logically. Always think, okay, what's the safest thing I can do here?
With that being said, especially, because one of the points I bring up, especially in paranormal research, whenever you're watching shows, a lot of people forget the fact that the job of the producer and the director of the show is to sensationalize what's being done.
They want views.
They want views. You got to sell the ad space, man.
Yeah.
I see a lot of practice on TV that people think is common practice of, ooh, I just saw something. I think I just got something. Let's stop and look at it. Is that your practice out in the field?
No.
Thank you.
That I do when I'm in the field is like, okay. Especially with Sasquatch, it's a smart creature. It knows when you're watching it.
Mm-hmm.
If you stop and watch it, it's going to walk away.
Yeah.
I say ignore until it comes closer.
Yeah,
ignore because the more it's with you, the more evidence you can capture.
Well,
if it's I'm just hearing it in the distance. Okay, how's it walking? Where is it walking?
Yep.
What type of behaviors can I try to infer from what I'm hearing or what I'm seeing.
Yeah. And even at that note, whenever you've got the recorder rolling, you know, to catch the hoops, the hollers, the whoops, the yells, to literally just have a notebook in your hand while you're sitting under the tree. Don't stop recording anything like that. Record your location, record the timestamp, the date. Yes. It was recorded at, you know, hour 122, yeah. minute 22.
It's all about the data.
Absolutely.
Like, that's what we're out there to collect, yeah. is data, not stories.
Well, and not just that, but it's looking at that data dispassionately.
Yes.
And not when you're adrenalized in the moment, not when you're excited and, oh, I think I got something. Because, yeah, you might now think you got something when you didn't.
Yeah,
because
you go home and you listen to the recording and like, okay, that was an owl.
Well,
that was a puma.
Well, and even the fact of like whenever I used to record bands, I would give them their CD. Don't listen to that on the way home. Don't listen to it tomorrow. Listen to it like Sunday. Give yourself like 24 hours to clear your head, clear the experience, and listen to it with cold ears so that you're listening to it dispassionately and you're separated from the moment, you know?
Well, even always get like a second or third opinion.
Yeah.
Like ask your friends that weren't there.
Yep.
Okay, what do you hear? What did you see in this picture?
Yeah.
And if they have an opinion that's different from yours, doesn't mean they're wrong.
No.
Or if you're right or you're wrong, it might be like, okay, let's see what did we actually see. Because one thing that I always talk to eyewitnesses about, eyes and the brain are not a camera. You do not remember things correctly. There are pseudo memories that your brain makes up.
That's why eyewitnesses are not ironclad in court.
Yes.
They're great, but they ain't going to make the case.
Yes. You can have 10 eyewitnesses, but if you have one piece of DNA, it trumps those 10 witnesses.
Every 10 of them. And every one of those will see that situation on the street through the filter in which they live life, straight up, and through their filter of experience.
Yes, your paradigm affects your perception.
Absolutely.
Like, I think I forget which crypto I talk about it, but I say your perception creates your own viewpoints.
So, oh, yeah.
Let's just say, for instance, Bigfoot. If you have what they call a Bigfoot on the brain, if you're out in the woods, everything you hear
is Bigfoot.
Going to be a Bigfoot.
Yeah.
It's all about perception and what you believe.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just it. And that's why some of it, especially, like I said, if you're sitting under the tree, be writing. Be doing something else. Let your ears be awake, but don't let your eyes deceive you while that's happening.
Yes.
You know, if your job is to be recording audio, be recording audio.
Yes.
Let the video person record the video, you know, that kind of stuff. And focus in on what you're doing.
Yes. So, and worry about what your own viewpoints bring to the table. Like, I think I bring it up in the Goatman page. A lot of people have this preconceived notion of a belief or something.
Mm.
If they have a preconceived belief in something, they expect to see it in their own reality.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, for instance, like, okay, I'm super religious, so I see Jesus' face in a...
Yeah, the phenomenology of what they're researching tends to go that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a double standard. A lot of people have a double standard in the field. And that's all it is this confirmation bias.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay,
absolutely.
don't just because you believe in something doesn't mean all your evidence should be finding against that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that... not just that all your evidence that you find should be toward that, but don't discount everything else that you find also.
Yes.
You know, so I want to thank you so much for taking the time. It's been absolutely fantastic to sit down with you. I've seen you set up outside with the vendors all day with your really, really awesome Australopithecus skull.
Well, Gigantopithecus.
Oh, Gigantopithecus, yes.
Good.
But I can't wait to get home. Crack this open over my upcoming trip. Tell everybody where they can go to follow you on social media, visit your website, follow your blog, podcast, where they can go to get your book. Time for shameless self-promotion, Ryan.
I'm always down for some shameless self-promotion. Well, on it, I do have a Facebook page. Just look for my name, Ryan Edwards. I also have an Instagram called redwards.cryptid25. If you want to get the book, it's available at most bookshops. Look for it at either Barnes & Noble, Half Price Books, Amazon, anything like that. It is there. It's newly published. It only came out last August.
Oh.
But I'm trying to get it out there. Like, I try to do events like this.
Absolutely.
And if you guys are wanting to follow me, just go look for my accounts. I'll be there. I'm always down to talk to eyewitnesses or people that are other researchers.
Yeah.
With me, I always love networking.
Absolutely.
Like, there's no such thing as an uninteresting person.
Yeah.
If you want to reach out to me, go ahead.
That's just it, man. Exactly. There is no such thing as an uninteresting person. You are more than an interesting person yourself, Ryan. So thank you so much for taking the time during this very, very busy Bigfoot Roadshow here in Mineola. We will definitely be having you on the show again and again. You're right down the road in San Antonio from us in Austin. So
yes,
as neighbors, we definitely need to get together and have you on the show more frequently. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the conference, man.
Of course.
While you are online checking out everything from Ryan, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all of the episodes. It's where you can find the free app that you can tune into our live streams like this, not only from on location, but live every Tuesday, 8 p.m. Central. Typically a live guest in the first hour, commercial break, followed by pre-recorded content. Here in the next couple weeks, I will be on the road. So you'll be, all of you who were not able to tune in live to this, will be able to hear the replays of this stuff during our full pre-recorded episodes that will be pushed out while I'm on the road. Stay tuned, folks. We have another guest before we end today. We will be back here in just a minute from the Texas Bigfoot Roadshow in Mineola. See you in just a minute. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to our final bit of coverage for the 2022 Bigfoot Roadshow here in Mineola, Texas, coming to you from the annex of the Select Theater, the historic Select Theater, one of the longest operating, continuously operating theaters in Texas. If you're ever around the Mineola area, make sure to stop on by and check the show. Make sure to stop on by and check out the Haunted Beckham Hotel. Great little bar there, fantastic cocktails if you are of age. Our final guest today, the author of Metroplex Monsters, Jason McLean. Welcome. How are you doing?
I appreciate it. I'm doing very well. I'm glad to be here. Having a lot of fun.
I'm always glad to see anybody coming out to community events like this, much less artists like yourself, authors like yourself, people involved in the community. It really is, like we've said with Craig Wohlheter, Ken Gerhardt, it's heartwarming to see even local communities come out and support such an event like this.
No, I'm right there with you. This is a time when we need to start building communities.
Yeah.
You know, we spent the last few years breaking them apart, and really the last few decades breaking them apart. We need to start coming together, both, you know, local communities, but then even as a larger, broader community that likes to, you know, to research the unknown, right? To answer these questions, we have to have conversations. Yeah. That means building a group of people that can come together, that can discuss things without getting so divisive.
Yeah, and so divisive, I think, is the important part there, because once again, as we discussed with other guests today, it can be hard to come forward with an account at any point in time, from the 1800s to now.
Oh yeah,
it could be a point of ridicule in your life, and it can be a point of discreditation for people with letters behind their names, you know, if they have a sighting, officers of the law, things like that. It's only literally since the public announcement of the ATIP program that it actively became okay for a pilot to report. Mm-hmm. Only then was it, if you see something, say something.
Yep.
Until then, is if you say something, we will take your license. We will revoke your flight status.
Shut up about it. Because, that was probably the biggest takeaway. Well, actually, I had a lot of takeaways from the book, but the thing that struck me the hardest was, I think a majority of people have had a lot of these encounters.
Mm.
I did not have to look hard and look hard to find people who'd seen things. I just had to ask random people questions. I think the majority of people have actually had an encounter, but they will not come forward for that reason.
Yeah, and even within families.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? Now, when you were researching and writing Metroplex Monsters, number one, I would have to understand that you're from the DFW area.
Yes, sir.
Just for those of you who are not from Texas or do not know what the Metroplex is, that is the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. But tell us a little bit about your experiences gathering these stories, the accounts that you got, and some of the things that you found right there in your own backyard.
Well, so the starting point is I had my own encounter when I was 12. And honestly, I didn't even talk about it with my family.
Yeah.
It took me a long time before I sort of came to terms with the fact that I'd had my encounter. And so once I started deciding I needed to write this book, I had taken some time off of work to really see if I could do this. And so I sort of made it public what I was doing, a lot of people I'd known for 20 years just came forward and said, okay, we need to talk about what happened to me when I was 15 or I was just out of college. And so a lot of the stories just came to me. But then while I was out doing research in the area, like for the Lake Granbury monster, which is called Old One Eye, I went out to take photographs and just get a feel for the lake, that kind of thing. I just started asking random people questions. And then what was funny is how often people would tell me things like, oh, I didn't know there was a monster in the lake, but I did have this weird encounter, right?
Interesting.
And so it's really, like I said, half the stories just came to me from people I'd known for a long time.
Wow.
But then the other half was just I would go to the area and just walk around and talk to people and say, hey, seen something weird.
Yeah.
That's it. And then they would tell me, and then they were like, yes. And they would, and like I said, what was weird is how often people didn't have a name for it. Like, they didn't know there was a Old One Eye at Lake Granbury. Mm. They just knew they'd had this weird encounter with this thing.
Yeah.
They didn't know that there were, living pterosaurs seen in North Texas, but they saw one.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, and we were just talking about the pterosaurs just a minute ago with Ryan. And that was one of those that... I remember when those reports happened.
Mm-hmm.
Even the presentation earlier that Daniel Allen Jones gave, one of the first cryptid things that I guess I ever heard of was the NASA gargoyle.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up in Houston, on the west side of Houston. Even going to school in Irving over near Grapevine, I've fished that lake that you're talking about numerous times when I was in college and after, and I don't think I ever heard of a cryptid story out there. Mm-mm. So even to know that right there in my own backyard, where I spent quite a bit of time in my life, that it was right there and I had no idea.
Well, and that's the whole thing. Like I said, I didn't say anything for well over 20 years because I didn't believe I could have seen what I saw. Mm. Because even though after I knew people had seen pterosaurs in Texas, but that's well south. I mean, Dallas is hundreds of miles away from the border.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, well, that's down there. That's not up here. This is one of the largest conurbations in the country. These things don't live here. I've never heard of anything being around here. They must not be here. And so that's a lot of this just comes down to perception.
Sure, sure. And now, what was your experience that led you down this?
It was a pterosaur.
Wow.
Yeah. No, I was 12. I was in the 10 Mile Creek, and for those who don't know, North Texas and Southern Oklahoma basically sit on this giant limestone slab.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our creeks,
seabed.
Exactly. Essentially, the ocean decided, oh, wait, I'm in Texas. I need to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so we were left with all this limestone. So the thing is, a lot of our rivers and creeks are cut into this limestone bed, and the 10 Mile Creek is one of those. It's like 10, most places 15, 20 feet into this limestone that's very, very wide in some places. So we just finished, fishing. It was summer. Key element is a lot of these are very sheer cliffs, but there are places where the walls collapse, right? Mm. And so you can get in, and it looks like a little rocky bank, and you can fish and do whatever you want. You know, it was a lot of fun growing up in the area. Well, my friend had already left. I had already packed up. It's about 10 in the morning. And I had just gotten inside the tree line when I heard a noise. It was a call I did not recognize, just something. I was like, what is going on? So I poked my head out from the tree line, and at first I think I'm looking at the largest blue heron I've ever seen in my life. 8 to 10 foot wingspan, because I can see the walls.
Yeah.
It's the right color. It's sort of a Payne's gray.
Yeah.
But once, because I'm elevated now, it gets right in front of my face. Literally, its right wingtip is 5 feet from my face.
Wow.
it's just flying. And I look at it, and that's when I realize I'm looking at something that doesn't have feathers. And what I thought had been its legs sticking out from behind it was actually a flanged tail, again, think of a long reptilian tail, but then at the very end, having like a diamond shape.
Yeah, like a paddle.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
A spade.
Mm-hmm.
Spade head.
And that's when I realized what I was looking at was a pterosaur.
Wow.
And I was like, I was basically in the middle of this straightaway.
Now, was it at that moment, or was it later in life that you realized that was what you were looking
at? I was very much into dinosaurs as a kid. So I knew what I was looking at was not, like, I was looking at a pterosaur.
Yeah.
But I didn't really think of things like a Rhamphorhynchus or whatever. I'm like, why does it have a tail? Because again, like most of us, I was I love dinosaurs, but I was more into the popular ones. So I'm you think pterosaur, you think pteranodon, right?
Yeah.
That's what they have in the Flintstones and Jurassic Park. Is what they have in all those movies. So I saw it, and I watched it, based on the straightaway, so I got a good look at it right here in front of me, then as it just goes and then banks and disappears from my life. I went home, pulled out this massive book of dinosaurs that I had, and I'm flipping through, and I'm like, what did I see? Because at that point, I'm still thinking, pteranodons, they have...
The swoop on the back of the
head,
the crest,
the big
cone,
they've got a beak, this didn't have a beak, and they didn't have tails. And I was like, it's a Rhamphorhynchoid. It's one of those. It's a Rhamphorhynchoid family because it didn't have a beak. It had a face. A reptilian snout.
Yeah, snouted.
And it had a long flanged tail. I'm like, that's what I'm looking at. But I was like, okay. I knew people had seen pterosaurs in South Texas at that point because I was already sort of into a lot of this stuff. But I'm like, that's not. That's not here. This is that's hundreds of miles away. My brain could not wrap around the idea that this thing was here. Where I live, that's for strange, exotic places like Loch Ness or, the Congo or San Antonio.
Yeah, it's that's just an incredible story. And to know that that was the stealing point of your life, that is what let you down this road.
And if you'd asked me this even a few years ago, I would have said, I don't really think much of it. But it's only in retrospect I can go back and say, oh, I can see how it affected me.
Mm.
Because I had the story. I didn't even tell my dad. And my dad would have believed me.
Sure.
It's like, I didn't believe myself for 20 years. And that's why I realized I was always open to somebody else's story.
Yeah.
Because I realized I had a story that I didn't believe. It was incredible even to me.
Yeah.
And so it's like, and I'm like, okay, well, the first thing I did was, like, the first little booklet I wrote was using artwork and art history to prove that the Rhamphorhynchoids had lived until very, very recently. There's ways of doing that. Again, I won't go into all the details here, but you can use sort of art history to prove this. And I was like, okay, so even then, it didn't click with me that's why what I was ultimately doing was pursuing it. And it wasn't until, like I said, really a year or two ago, I was like, oh, I see what happened.
Yeah.
We don't always know why we're doing the things that we do at the time, but in retrospect, you can kind of go back and piece those things together and be like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And with that in mind, going back, piecing things together, what have you pieced together thus far, especially in your local area, and what are you looking at investigating right now?
So, I'll answer that last one first.
Okay.
Right now I am, I know this is more of a Bigfoot thing. And again, the programs I'm on, they tend to lean more towards Bigfoot and stuff like that.
Sure.
I am more interested in the pterosaurs for a number of reasons. One, they're reptiles. You could argue whether or not Sasquatch is intelligent, is it human, is it what, but it's clearly smart enough to stay away from us and actively.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what's happening with the Rhamphorhynchoids. I think that what they are doing is they're just living their lives. They are mostly nocturnal. I have several broad daylight sightings, but it's early mornings before noon at least.
Okay.
Right. But they do appear to be mostly nocturnal. They are not so outlandishly large, at least the ones in North Texas, that they stand out immediately. And their coloration is either a dull red or a or a Payne's gray. I think we're seeing sexual dimorphism when you when you look at differing colors, and some have head crests, you know, small head crests, some don't. I think we're looking at sexual dimorphism with there. But the way they fly, right, they do the S-curve thing with their neck, like the way a crane will. I think they look so much like cranes when they fly that when most people see them, they don't recognize what they're... They just think it's a crane, they move on. That's what I did. And literally everyone I've spoken to said, I thought it was a heron. I thought it was a pelican carrying something. I got one that said I thought it was an owl, but that's because she saw it at night. It came right by her car. It wasn't until it was in the headlights that she realized... She's like, it's a dinosaur. Okay, technically not a dinosaur. It's they're reptiles, but from the average person, they're saying that's a dinosaur.
And that's just it. It was a mid step point between the two. But even with that being said, especially whenever you're talking about this critter specifically and its blunted snout, the first thing that pops into my head is Jersey Devil.
Absolutely. That's actually one of the things, one of the conclusions I've come to is I think the Jersey Devil is the Ramphractoid. I think people saw it. And the thing is, when most people say, okay, but the Jersey Devil looks like this weird thing over here, it's like, no, that is what a newspaper artist in Philadelphia who did not take this seriously.
Most of them have almost a horse-shaped head, like a pony-shaped head, things like that. And, you know, when you're talking about Ramphractoid and you go and look up their head, like... They're pretty similar to the accounts.
Yeah.
You know, especially the front on view, the red eyes, things like that.
Yeah. The
blunted
the
snout.
Oh, blunted snout. Again, the bifurcated tail.
Yep.
Right? It's when you look at it, it's like, okay, the problem is when most people describe something, they describe what they know.
Yeah.
People did not know what dinosaurs were back then. So they were just trying to describe what they knew. And we see this throughout history as well. You go back and you look at a lot of these older, you know, dragons or even the unicorn, right?
Yeah.
What they're doing is they are describing something in their own context. Yeah. And if you take what they're saying seriously, not literally, but seriously, you can reconstruct what they're looking at. One of my favorite versions of this is actually the cockatrice, right?
Yep.
It's like this. It's the weirdest looking dragon you've ever seen. But if you stop and realize what they're saying, it's a dragon supposed to be half chicken, half dragon.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, that's weird. Well, but that's only because we've only now realized that a lot of theropods had feathers.
That's right.
So if you're banging around Persia 3,000 years ago and you see something like an oviraptor, right, it has a beak. It's a theropod, which means it probably had feathers, but not completely covered in feathers. And it's just, how would you describe that?
Yeah.
It's a chicken.
Yeah, like an Archaeopteryx.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's a chicken that's also a dragon.
Yeah.
Right? That's the only thing you're going to come up with. And particularly if they have, again, since we know there is some sort of, particularly the theropods are related to birds, it's like, they could even have things like wattles and head crests. It's like,
that's right.
It's
absolutely.
Like, and that's the only way to describe it.
Especially whenever you're looking at, I guess, the modern day equivalent, whenever you're talking about these colorations, would be like a cassowary.
Oh, absolutely.
Where it's like a bright blue with dark red, the wattle coming down. But when you look at a cassowary, it has a very, as opposed to its cousins like the emu, the rhea, stuff like that, it does have a very reptilian look to its face.
Oh, it absolutely does. And
the skin texture as well.
Oh, and if you've ever seen the actual, the original crest. Chickens. Yeah, the crest. It's got bright red.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's very prominent. Even look at the original, like the chickens we have today are not the chickens that start off. You go look at the jungle fowl that the chickens were bred out of, they're very colorful.
Oh, hugely colorful.
And they're really actually, they're quite pretty.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the whole point is you have some guy who's, you know, they have chickens and they, you know, you have the dragon mythos and you see something like an oviraptor or just some other theropod. That's the only thing you're going to have to say it. So the problem is if you take it seriously, but not literally, then you realize they're just trying to convey information. And we see that all throughout history.
Sure.
Now, even the dragon that's on the Ishtar Gate, right, very, very famously, it's like, okay, that doesn't look like any dinosaur we know. But you have to remember, the artist didn't actually see it.
Yeah.
He is simply, or, you know, they were simply trying to recreate what they had been told.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you realize, okay, what you're looking at is something that has bird-like feet, but, you know, sharp front claws.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We're, you know, there's any number of theropods that could have been. Again, longer neck. It's like, okay, this looks like a number of dinosaurs that we have the fossil that we have in the fossil record. But we just, because we say they died off millions of years ago, and the book is closed on that, we never entertain the idea that they have survived to modern times.
Well, and the point I bring up regularly on the show, especially in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. is don't forget, last year we were still locked down in a pandemic. The
yeah.
whole world, we discovered over 1,000 new species.
Yep. Oh, exactly.
Not, and that's just terrestrial. That's not underwater.
Right.
That's
oh, absolutely.
Birds, insects, reptiles, mm-hmm. things like that. And that's while we were in a worldwide pandemic lockdown.
Yeah.
The average is closer to 3,000 to 4,000
oh,
on the
exactly.
year.
Oh, exactly.
So we are constantly discovering these things. Even
yes.
all of a decade ago, there was the pygmy reindeer
yeah.
that was found in the forests of Vietnam that the local indigenous had talked about for years that had, like, almost gill-like
yeah,
flaps
yeah, the gill
on the
flaps.
Side of its
yes,
nose.
Yes,
and yeah, uh-huh. researchers that were out researching wildlife were like, yeah, okay, dude, whatever. Found.
Yeah.
Found. Proven to be a real species. These things
oh,
had been talked about by the natives
mm-hmm.
for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And the scientists were like, yeah, okay, dude,
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, another thing we tend to forget is the Earth has been through numerous climactic shifts. I think, you know, we forget
we're the last thing to come around, quite literally.
Yeah. And it's like, well, no, exactly. And it's like 1,000 years ago, the Earth went through another really dramatic and climactic shift. It's like
the micro ice age.
Exactly. It's like, well, guys, is it entirely possible that there were these, that even if a lot of these things aren't alive today, that doesn't mean that they weren't alive 500 years ago or 1,000
right.
years ago.
Well,
maybe the climactic shift was the last thing needed to put them into extinction. It doesn't mean they didn't exist 1,000 years ago.
And oddly enough, that climactic shift that you're talking about is right as the stories of dragons in China stopped.
Yep.
Right as the stories of dragons like the one that St. George conquered stopped. Even which we just passed St. George's Day, actually.
Exactly.
And even the giant salamander that they were
absolutely.
Out looking for. People forget the fact that there's a newt and there's a salamander. And traditionally, the salamander was a fire-breathing water dragon.
Yeah, absolutely.
So people forget these things. Like, mm-hmm. that's why whenever you see a salamander in the tarot card, that is a sign of fire.
Yes.
Things like that. And all these small esoteric things that have happened throughout humanity, mankind, we have totally and utterly forgotten.
Yeah. It's our hubris. The hubris of the modern age is that we know better than people before us.
Well, and the prime example of a conspiracy theory that we give on the show all the time is Flat Earth.
Yeah.
Never forget that until the last 500 years of human history, the Earth was flat.
Yeah.
And to think otherwise was anathema. You were burned at the stake. You were excommunicated. You were driven from your town. To think otherwise was absolute witchery.
Yeah.
Literal witchery. You would be accused of being a witch. That was 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have been around as a humanity for 10,000 years, at a minimum, if you go by science. So that's a long time where we actively and worldwide believed something totally. Now, granted, sure, the Greeks, the Egyptians, they thought the world was round. They had the math to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of us, not so much.
Well, not to get off too much in that.
Sure.
Because it is. Even that's sort of a bit of an overstatement. It's like people did think it was, the common man thought it was flat.
Yes.
And there's,
High thinkers didn't.
Yeah, the high thinkers, they realized, but it's just they didn't think the common man was worth re-educating.
Yeah.
And even in Europe, like Galileo didn't really get into trouble because of heliocentrism. It was really more of a political thing.
It was because he was teaching in the name of the church, and he could not prove it through Aquinian proof that it was the center of the solar system.
Right, exactly. And that's no, precisely. And that's one of those vagaries that it gets lost in a lot of these conversations.
Absolutely.
But the bigger point for me is science is limited by two things. Our ability to observe something. And the scientists themselves doing the work. The problem is, I can point 100 things over the last 20, 30, 40 years that we knew it was scientific fact.
Oh.
Until Oh, look, hey. We just realized we screwed up all of the science. Hey,
I have my high school textbook from astronomy. Mm-hmm. One of the only classes I ever made straight A's in.
Yep.
There is no Pluto on my son's planet map.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say. It's not there.
Yep.
Scientific fact my whole life. I was born in 1975.
Yep.
All of about 10 years ago. Nope. Planetesimal. Take it off the map.
Yep.
So, prime example. Science is always... If science is stagnant, it's not science. It's mm-hmm. doctrine.
Exactly. And my the thing I always like to point to is... Did bacteria and viruses exist 500 years ago?
Ooh.
You know, people are going to say, no. It was like, well, of course they existed 500 years ago. I'm like, really? Yeah. Because if you walked around 500 years ago saying, the reason we all get sick is because there are tiny animals that are so small, they're invisible.
Oh, they
call
that dude crazy.
Exactly.
Straight up. No, it's ether. It's ether that yeah. makes us sick.
Exactly. There's no.
It's bad air.
Exactly. If you had said all... if you had, you could be as true. It didn't matter because you didn't have the ability to observe it.
Yeah.
So when I hear people say, well, science says, stop. Science yep. doesn't ever say anything.
Yeah.
Scientists or, say something.
It proves or disproves.
Right.
Does.
And the problem is just because if you can't observe it, and particularly when, you know, this gets off for like paranormal things,
sure.
it's like, look, if it's paranormal, then it's outside our normal. We don't have yeah. the ability to properly yeah. observe it. Then the best science can ever say is, we can't talk about it.
That's right.
Now, you could... Now,
I don't have an educated opinion on that.
Yeah, because we don't have any way of observing yeah. it. Now, you could say we have a number of accounts that suggest that there is something to the phenomena, but we can't observe the phenomena, therefore we cannot speak to it. That should be the end of the conversation.
Absolutely.
And yet, that's not the end of most conversations. It's, no, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you have to stop and say, well, hold on.
It starts with no, and eventually you might get yeah. them after a few arm twists to go, well,
yeah.
yeah, of course, with the evidence we have now and with what we can collect and record.
Yeah.
Who knows 20 years from now?
Right. And yeah. it's like, but they don't give you that because, to your point, it's not science, it's doctrine.
That's it.
And the thing that we often forget is everyone says, oh, it's religion versus science. No. It's religion versus religion.
That's it.
Science
that's
is
it.
A tool.
Yep.
Science is nothing more than a tool. You have two religions duking it out. One claims science as an yep. absolute, but the problem is it's whatever science they want. It's whatever science they like. Any science they don't like magically disappears.
We do not have an applause button, but now I want to put one on here. Because
hey.
That deserves a rounding round of applause. And quite literally,
I can't wait
to dig into this book. I want to have yeah. you on the show again and again,
oh,
especially
my honor.
Talking about pterosaurs, things like that. It's a wild topic here in Texas, but one that not a lot of people are familiar that it's out there.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like out there. There were
mm-hmm.
and sightings into the 90s, folks.
Oh,
so,
I have a sighting from... Well, technically, it's 2 years ago now.
Wow. Stop on by. Check out the book. Let them know where they can go to get the book. Let them know where they can go to follow you on social media, where they can go to Google stalk you.
Yes.
Get in touch with their sightings, things like that.
Okay. Well, you can buy the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's from our Arcadia Press. So you can buy it pretty much anywhere. Amazon and Barnes & Noble is probably the easiest. For that. And if you would like a Kindle version, you can do that. If you want to cyber stalk me, I'm a terribly boring person. But I am on Facebook as Jason McLean. Or you can go to Texas Front Porch.
Okay.
I'm there every Monday on that channel. And actually, I've got, by the end of this week, I'll have three shows on that channel.
All right.
Or you can go to Siru Papers, SIRUpapers.com. That's my main website that has, you know, my links to everything, all my other books and
great.
Stuff like that.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time here on the cascading end of our full day. I mean, like
pleasure.
I said all day, I am more than impressed with this event
yeah.
and with the crowd that came out. It was a great show out of a town coming
yes.
to show out and show
absolutely.
Support of a great community. So thank you yep. so much for your time. We greatly appreciate it. Make sure to stop on by Siru Papers.
Yeah, SIRUpapers.com.
There you go. Make sure to stop on by. Check out everything that Jason is doing over there. Make sure to stop on by and buy the copy of Metroplex Monsters. Once again, I cannot wait to get into this. I've had a great time here today. It's been fantastic. Cannot wait for more upcoming festivals. We will be sponsoring so many things with our good friend Craig Woolheater, Folk Monster Festival, Texas Bigfoot Festival, Texas Bigfoot Film Festival, Texas UFO Con. Our next one coming up will actually be the Folk Monster Festival. We will be doing some great stuff out there as well. After that, don't forget, folks, MUFONCON, Denver, Colorado. We will be coming to you live from there as well. Take care, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Remember, stay curious. We'll talk to y'all soon. Take care from the Mineola Bigfoot Festival, everybody. Bigfoot Roadshow. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much, Southeast Texas Bigfoot.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.